Hello, world. Hope you're all doing well. Welcome to another episode of the Collective Podcast. This is going to be episode 214 with designer, photographer, art director, creative director, just an awesome person, Heidi Berg. It's amazing to have her on. I've been a fan of her work for quite some time now, and we've been trying to get an episode set up for a bit, and we finally did it, and it was just awesome. Such a cool conversation. We talk about all kinds of different things. It's typical Collective Podcast style, or it bounces all over the place, and we talk about a lot of random things. But I just really enjoyed this episode. It was a lot of fun, and getting to know Heidi a bit more and just kind of understand how she approaches things and just the overall creative process. It's been really cool. So I'm not going to kind of go too far into the details of this conversation. I really want you to enjoy them without me telling you about them. But it was just awesome. Really enjoyed it. So big thank yous, obviously, to Heidi. This is going to be episode 214. Let's begin. Yeah, my wife's like, you have a podcast on Labor Day? I'm like, what's Labor Day?
Okay, but
every day is Labor Day, baby.
Exactly. Like, nothing becomes a real holiday anymore. It's funny. Like, when you are doing work, you kind of just sort of steamroll through these things. But I'm the same way. People are always like, oh, are you going to work on Monday? I'm like, yes, why? It's Labor Day. Oh, okay. Yeah sure. I'll work.
Yeah, because it is Labor Day. So you're supposed to work. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I can tell from what I gather from your work is that you love what you do, because I can feel it in your work. So it's like, it's not the end of the world if you have to work.
We're in a mine. That's the joy of it, right? Like, just having passion for these things and like being able to work on it's very fortunate in a lot of ways. It's painful, but it's also like incredibly fortunate when you think about it.
Yeah, the duality and the trying to balance it is super oddly difficult. I've been doing these like on Instagram, I do these like questions where people can ask anything, and a lot of repetitive questions come up, and a lot of it has to do with like balance and stuff. And people are like, "How do you balance all this stuff?" And I'm like, "Man, I don't feel like I should be the one giving advice on this, honestly, because I am not a balanced person." So,
I there's very few creatives I've actually met who have found a way to very clearly delineate between their work life, you know, like their passion and their career, and then their personal life. More often than not, I think these things just sort of, they tend to bleed into each other. I mean, it's almost impossible to separate your personality, which is kind of your career, and then go back into your normal life, because you're still you, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. And I feel like, it's like you have to kill your ego in a weird way in order to switch that off. And my ego is like, nah, not going to do it. We're going to go full steam for the rest of your life, for the last two years that you have, because we're going to burn you out.
Yeah. And we're just going to pretend we're not aging, right?
Yeah. I'm not aging. Yeah. No, it's really weird.
It's not a real thing.
Well, I'm 36 now, and I think about it more than ever, because I'm like, shit, I'm coming up on 40. I'm over the hump, you know? And I'm like, damn, like, this is intense. This is going to be really intense. and I don't know how to deal with it, because for the longest time, I was always like, yeah, I'm not going to, you know, whatever. It's not going to be a big deal. I'll just live.
Yeah.
Cause when you're young, I think you just think that, now I'm like, ah, crap, this is going to suck.
It's really interesting, because I think we grow up with these kind of mythologies of what it means to age. And, you know, at first it's kind of like this fear, this, you know, I'm never going to be that person. You watch movies and you're like, oh man, that person's so old. Honestly, last night I was rewatching Escape from New York.
Oh man. Classic.
It's so good. Oh, it's still so good. But
Carpenter.
I, you know, exactly.
It's and so badly
I
was looking good. At, yeah.
It's so badly good. I mean, the comps in there were just like so satisfying to look at, because they were just so, they just do not hold up. But I remember looking at the character of Snake when I ever first saw it, and I'm like, man, he's so old. But that he, literally, I don't know how old he actually is in that film, but he's probably in his late 20s, honestly. But I'm like, oh, such an old man. But way beyond that now.
The John Carpenter lens adds 40 years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the colors.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Utah, just like barely outside of Salt Lake City, like
a few minutes. I saw on, I think it was, I can't remember where I saw it, but UT, I guess that's what you said. And I was like, UT, yeah. Okay, it must be Utah. Utah is really beautiful. Yeah, it's really gorgeous up there.
It's a really, just landscape-wise, it's an absolutely gorgeous place to grow up. I remember my partner, the first time I took him there just to kind of visit my family and see things, he was like, wait, this is where you grew up? I'm like, yes. And he's like, this looks like Switzerland. And I'm like, yeah, it's beautiful. It's really, really beautiful. But, you know, we all have our baggage that comes with where we grew up, you know?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's all about those memories and like how you shed that, you know? So, but yeah, Utah is, it's really, it's cool. Like I travel to Europe quite a bit through the year and I'm always like, wow, it's so small here. It's like a little baby, little baby America. All the European fans are like, shut the hell up, dude. Yeah. But it is.
We're in Austria. Up in arms right now.
Yeah. I was in Austria and we were in Vienna. My friend Frank drove us around. In 30 minutes, boom, we're in Czech Republic. I was like, whoa, this is weird. Like, it takes me like 50 minutes just to get to jujitsu.
No, entirely. And it's so funny because I had to do a shoot this year in Slovenia and it was kind of the same experience. We were driving around and we had a few locations and one of these beach locations we were trying to shoot at, it didn't work out. We showed up and the beach was too tiny, like way too tiny. So then we had to do a quick search and we were mostly based in Slovenia, but then the options available to us was like, oh, here's 5 in Italy that we could go to within an hour. Here's like 3 down in Croatia. That's less than an hour away. And it was just really fascinating to be able to kind of move between the countries like so easily just to like get another location. Whereas if we were here, it would be hours and hours. We'd have to fly somewhere else. It's crazy.
Yeah, it always trips me out. I'm like, wow, America's huge. Then, like, when you go to Russia, Russia's massive. So, yeah, it's really fascinating.
I yet to go to Russia. Is it nice?
I went to Moscow, and the people were amazing. I'm not a huge city person, though, so I'm not the best to judge that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, it had its moments, and there were some really cool things there and some stuff. It was like, yeah, whatever, I could leave it, but... Yeah. But,
so are you more like barren wilderness type or?
Yeah. I grew up in Hawaii primarily. So I'm much more in the tropical nature side, but I'm not into the heat. So I really like the woods and stuff. That's kind of where my head dwells most of the time. I live kind of close to this mountain and I go up there all the time. And it's just like, it's awesome. I was just up there. It was too hot and there's bugs everywhere. I was like, man, I don't like it when it's like this. I want convenient nature, not this like nature that bites me.
Yeah. No, it's funny. Actually, when I first, I moved down from San Francisco to Los Angeles. And when I first came here, I randomly went up to Topanga and I was kind of blown away because there were parts of it that felt a bit more wilderness oriented, kind of like Utah. So I figured I might move up there for a year or so just to have the break from the city and just be able to live in the middle of nowhere. But Topanga, as it turns out, is a really weird place. It's not what I imagined, but I did try to just get away from the craziness of it all. It's funny.
Yeah. How do you like living in LA and how long have you been there?
Let's see. I came here in 2008 is when I first came down and it's kind of been like a weird little path of going from, it was Santa Monica and then it was up to Topanga. And then I think it was like somewhere a bit more sort of like Wilshire mid city ish. And now I'm kind of over right on the border of K-Town next to Largemont. And it's funny. I've had this conversation with a few people about how, when you first get here, you immediately go to the ocean and then slowly you kind of start moving farther and farther east, like towards downtown Los Angeles.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I've had a few other people do this. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
But LA is such a like interesting place to me because I kind of,
it's a good word.
Interesting. I think at one point I probably promised myself that I wouldn't ever move to Los Angeles when I was young. And then I ended up here. So it grows on you. Like, I think I came here for work because there's so much of it as opposed to everywhere else where I was looking. And then it just kind of, it plants a little seed inside you, and then you get to know the neighborhoods and you get to know like the flavor of the people, and it just sort of like continues to grow from that point on. And so I think even though my default is to always kind of say I don't like LA very much, it does become like this weird sibling that you can't let go of.
Yeah, there's a weird thing. I totally agree. My brother lived there for a long time. He was in the film industry like as a grip, and he did a lot of stuff, and I would go and visit him all the time. I've been in San Diego for quite some time now. It's like, mm-hmm. And I always say like people go to LA to work and people go to San Diego to live. And it's a total truth because people live really well here, I think. But yeah, I always had like a love hate weird relationship. It's like, have you seen that? I think it's called, what's that movie called? It's got that one actor in it. That's the best advice. That's the best.
I love this. You're explaining things just how I explain things. I'm like, ask that one guy from, you know, that like, I don't know, like 92 or something. That's exactly how I describe all films.
I suck at that. It's got, yeah, let's see. I'm trying to find the IMDb.
Yeah, IMDb.
I know the actor. So it's got Michael Douglas, and he's in LA, and it's like really shitty. It's like something down, something like a. I gotta find it.
And I are probably not the best people to figure this out together because I also will not know this.
Yeah, dang it.
Like I might have seen it, but I would never be able to recall the name of it.
Falling Down. Yeah, Falling Down. Yeah.
Falling Down. Yeah. No, I actually haven't seen this.
Oh, really? Okay, that's how it is for me in LA. I was just out there the other night, and I have an NSX and super low, and it's really all fast and stuff. And I went out to visit a friend who has one as well, and I drove out there and like it's like this weird car thing, but I was out there and I was like, oh god, this is crazy. Like there's road construction everywhere and it's just like pure chaos and madness. But yeah, Falling Down is I feel like it's like the like one of the inspirations behind Breaking Bad, kind of in a sense. It's like a normal guy just completely going off,
loses
the edge.
His shit.
Yeah, it's an interesting film, but yeah, it's actually really well done, really well photographed for the most part. Michael Douglas always delivers for me. So,
oh yeah,
yeah,
he's always amazing.
He's an amazing
continuously.
Asshole. Yeah, on camera, I don't know him personally, but yeah, but that's interesting that you say that about LA. Yeah, because it does have that effect. I don't know if I could ever live there, simply because of that weird feeling I get when I'm there. It just doesn't feel right.
Because you lived here for how long? Before you went back to San Diego, or were you always in San Diego?
Yeah, I've always been in San Diego. I would just commute up there to work and stuff. So,
oh man,
and I did that for
a crazy commute.
Yeah, it was brutal. But it's kind of like what you got to do to in order. Like back when I started, it seems like it's so long ago, but it was maybe like 9 years ago now. It was kind of hard to go to anywhere other than like LA for me, at least, to get that first kick, you know, that start.
Yeah.
Because of where the studios are and stuff. But I mean, are you working with Elastic now? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah. Elastic is kind of funny because I've been freelance since I was staff at Motion Theory. And then that's kind of when I jumped off and went freelance. And that's been, I want to say like 7 years or so. Mm. And so I am one of those freelancers who could not commit to any studio or any one person. I really liked to just kind of keep playing the field and sort of, you know, find the next project, find the new thing. Mm-hmm. And Elastic, I think the first time I ever went in there was when it was probably when Patrick Clare first joined them, and they were in like a tiny, tiny cubicle in the middle of rock, paper, scissors. And there was only maybe, I think Elastic was comprised of probably 8 people, maybe less. And I was freelance. So I came in and we'd work on some fun things and I'd leave. And I'd keep coming back to the different phases of Elastic to see them constantly growing. And then I want to say two years ago, it might be closer to 2.5 now. I came in, I think it was for The Terror, to work with Patrick Clare and then that team. And then I got roped into, we were working on the marketing for The Alienist. And The Alienist was kind of what solidified me sort of planting my feet a little bit at Elastic, because I loved that book for a number of years. And it was kind of interesting because a friend of mine who I work with a lot, we were trying to develop that book into a TV series. Like, he contacted me and he's like, look, the author lives next to my parents. It's never, the films they've made out of it have never done well. So we were obsessed with this book and we're just looking to develop it. And it was hilarious because then when we heard it was being developed and by who it was being developed by, we're like, okay, that's great. Like, we missed our chance, but this is fantastic. I'm sure they'll do a great job with it. Yeah. So it was a weird sort of full circle when I got to start working on the marketing for The Alienist and then moved into working on the main titles for The Alienist, because I just love that book. it's such a good story. So it was,
what's it about? Without spoilers, I guess.
Without spoilers, I'll watch out. So The Alienist is kind of, it's such a weird title. And we kind of went back and forth on this as we were developing it, because the first time you hear that term, The Alienist, you're kind of like thinking sci-fi, aliens, etc. But it's really about kind of the beginning of criminal psychology. And that's what an alienist was back in the times, like 1800s, essentially, in New York. It was, an alienist was pretty much your therapist. That's who you would go to, or the person who would show up in court to sort of analyze if a criminal was insane or not. So the story is really based on this character who is a psychologist, psychiatrist, and he's almost like a detective in a way. It's a bit of a murder mystery detective story that's taking place. And he kind of pulls apart cases and the criminology of it through the psychology of it. So it's really fascinating because it's not just about, I mean, there are the early developments of identifying fingerprints and things like this, like really, really early forensic science. But it's more the profiling, like the psychological profiling, that's incredibly fascinating in the book. And the author, he's a historian naturally, so there's an insane amount of detail. And this book, I think the way he actually originally sold it, because he was writing just historical novels before that, is he told everybody that it was a true story. And then kind of tricked them into being interested. And when they read it, he's like, okay, just kidding. It's actually fiction I wrote, but Fargo it is based style. Off. Yeah, exactly.
It's based off of like half truths and stuff.
Yes, exactly.
Sounds which like are Mindhunter kind of the best, round one. You like Mindhunter?
I do. The first season of Mindhunter I loved. I haven't started the second one, actually.
It's really good. It gets better even. Like, it just keeps going. There's a couple of things I'm like, but like for the most part, it's awesome. It's very well done.
Yeah. It was so good.
So this, should I read this book or can I listen to it?
You know, either or. Okay, I don't know. It's a very long book. You could probably just watch the TV show, although that's kind of obviously not entirely the same.
Yeah. I kind of love listening. Like, the thing when I know that a book is like turned into a different medium, sometimes it depends on what it is. Like No Country for Old Men, I watched the movie and then I read the book and then I read the script and I was like, wow, this is really interesting how this translates.
Right.
So I'm curious about
that. I love
that,
tracking that process. Yeah. Because like, the way, like, adapting things is just so fascinating.
Yeah. It's very weird because it's almost like somebody had this impetus of a thought that really like resonated with them. And then they took the time and used all their skills to like bring it into life. And then somebody else is like, wow, I really like that. And then they took their skills and then said, this is how I see it. And then it's always weird. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I'm always very curious as to like, oh, that's interesting why they didn't do that. And I wonder how come that. And I mean, you'll never know unless you're the people making it, but you kind of have an idea. And it, for me, it's always interesting. So I'm going to add this to my Audible account.
Because I put it on there.
I do a lot of, do you listen to books much?
I am old school and I really just like have to touch paper. So I love reading books. So I try to carve out as much time as I can to read books. I just love reading, quite honestly. That's almost like the number one process too when I'm working on projects. Like, we get a lot of scripts and that's like the first thing I love to do is just mine the script for little like gems and tokens of concepts that we could develop either into the main title or the promo or whatever it is. But just, I just love reading. It's magical.
It is. I love that that's awesome because I feel like I've met a lot of people and they're like, yeah, I don't read. And like, that's just weird. Why don't you read? That's
a weird thing. My sister is one of those. I actually have a lot of friends who, I feel like there's been a rise in just an inability to sit down and pay attention to something for long enough. Do you know what I mean? Like, it completely makes sense in, you know, our modern times, but it is, I would completely say it is very hard nowadays to sit down and just read a book. And I don't mean like a newspaper or like an article, like actually read an entire book.
Yeah. It is a challenge, and you have to have had that like in you before like the internet. Because the internet has you set up for like, it's like almost like all you can eat buffet of like shitty food. like you're going to get filled up, but you're going to feel like shit after. And I think like, I don't know. Like I do a lot of Audible because reading physically sometimes makes me tired, like sleepy. Mm-hmm. I just get like in a trance mode, or my mind wanders and I'll have to go over the page multiple times, which is like, it drives me nuts because my mind is always like,
you're like rereading the same sentence five times. You're like, damn it.
It's a real problem. There's a book that I actually have called The Shallows, and it talks all about like how our minds have been developed over the times and the eons of evolution to be like, to be able to have deep thought and to go into deep thought. But the internet has like hijacked that, and it's created this like epidemic of non-deep thinking people. And, in the land, the blind, you know, it's like, that's like, that's why I like to read. I feel like it gives me an edge, and it makes me feel like I'm different from like the rest of like the Twitter feed people. So
It is funny how it's changed, right? Because I think about the time, obviously before the internet, but even right after the internet, where this wasn't our normal way of reading or doing things, and all the books weren't online, etc. But it was just we all read, or some people didn't read, depending, but it was very normal. And now it has become very much, there's levels, right? There's people who read books. There's people who read, you know, on their iPads. There's people who, and also the form in which we read. You know, I talk to so many people who think it's so weird that I still buy books. Mm. My friend, he's like a huge advocate for just getting rid of waste and paper. And I completely understand that, but he hates that I order like physical books. He just thinks it's like all this clutter in my house, but
no.
Everybody's kind of different. Like there's something, for me, there's something so nice about just the textural quality of holding something while I'm also kind of trying to get into it at the same
time. It's a bit like, I guess it is kind of old school, but I love that too. And I read, especially when I travel, like when I'm on the plane and stuff, I'll always have a book with me. The thing I look at with books, and they vary for me personally between like fictional. I rarely read fiction. I listen to it usually, but like when I'm reading a book, I feel like I'm going in a time machine and I'm going into somebody's mind, you know, whatever year it was that they made it. And I'm kind of going into that. And I just love that. Like, remember like, Neverending Story, the movie?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's like
that. So good.
It's still, but that book, right?
Yes. He gets like fully wrapped into it and he's just absorbed in this world.
People that read and love to read and have an imagination of their own, when they watch that movie, they go like, yeah, it's exactly how it goes. Like, and that is like, I was lucky that I'm actually dyslexic, and I had a lot of learning disabilities growing up. Like I was in special education for a big part of my early education, but I found that reading like was the thing that really like pulled me in, because going into somebody's imagination and like seeing all of it, and man, that is so, so powerful cognitively. Mm-hmm. Like if you can do that and really commit to it and love it, like,
yeah,
it's game changing. Like, especially
it really is
for people that like ourselves who create like visuals from translated word. It's like, wow, I don't know. Super powerful tool.
It's fantastic.
If you're listening and you don't like reading, then change that. Yeah.
Change it.
Yeah.
Try it out. Hold a book.
Try it out. Yeah. What's the last book that you read that you were really excited about or really enjoyed?
Oh man, there's a few. I think I'm trying to think of the last one I was endlessly talking about. People at work get annoyed because I come in and I'm like, you have to read this book. There's probably three. You can just send it to me then.
I'm like, all right, cool. I'll read it.
There's so many. I'm kind of like you, where I'm not entirely into fiction. It really depends on the fiction. And if I come across it, it's almost on accident. I've been like on a bit of a nutrition kick, just about, you know, like what it means to eat plants versus animals, et cetera, et cetera. So I've been reading this thing called like the China Study. I don't know if you've read that. It's horrifying and amazing at the same time. I'm still getting into it, but it's just a lot of details I didn't think I necessarily wanted to know about what's going on in our bodies when we eat meat and cancer, etc. It's really fascinating.
Wow.
But terrifying.
Yeah. I think I've been holding off being vegan and like full vegetarian for many years because, to be completely honest, like meat tastes so good. And but I love animals, and I don't know how I feel about it. It's really kind of a complicated subject, obviously, for everybody.
It's complex. And that's why I don't try to get too preachy on it, because I'm sort of also working through my own emotions and feelings on it at the same time. But that book is crazy. I would highly recommend it. Okay. Yeah. The China Study is really interesting. It's scary for facts. It's good to know. But then the other one, I don't know if you've read, I'm trying to remember her name, Tara Westover. She wrote a book called Educated, and she came from, I was really into this book because one of my friends at work asked me if I'd read it. He said it reminded him of me because she grew up in Idaho. She grows up just outside of Idaho with a very kind of fundamentalist Mormon family. They're Mormon, but they're a bit more, you know, like the survivalist type. So not the polygamy, but more about just like always waiting for the apocalypse and sort of planning for the apocalypse. And that's like a branch of Mormonism that I've known some people that way. And it just kind of spirals out. So she wrote a kind of memoir of what her life was like growing up this way. Mm. And it is so, it's just really, really powerful. Just, her as a person, her journey, and, just her reflections on life. She just has an incredible trajectory, and it's such a good book. It's awesome. Written so well. I think it's the first book she ever wrote as well. And it's beautiful.
Oh, cool. So it's like really pure then, coming right from the source.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, exactly.
That's really cool. I'm trying to add that to my Audibles. Okay. Got it there too. Tara Westover. Got it. Okay. Yeah.
It's kind of, really, I don't know if you read J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. He kind of talks about like growing up with, you know, in like a very poor white neighborhood, and just sort of looks at the spectrum of, privilege. And it's just a really interesting commentary, and hers is somewhat in that vein. Mm. But still very, very personal at simultaneously, but it's a really beautiful book.
Interesting. Yeah. I don't know. I'm like, oh man, I don't want to visit that again. Cause I lived it.
See, that's what's hard. Do you know what I mean? Like there's a certain amount of, I don't want to say, you know, like enjoying the pain of it. But when I read that book, it was very painful to read Tara, however you say her name, because there's parts of it that it brings up a lot of memories, and it brings up a lot of things that were difficult from my own childhood. Mm. But at the same time, she was putting a different perspective on it that kind of made me relook at things and sort of revisit it. Because a lot of times I let the old narratives of how I grew up, the scary ones particularly, take over, and then I don't ever want to revisit it. But sometimes when I do look back, it kind of neutralizes it, makes it a little bit easier every single time. So I'd say there's a certain amount of, if you have a history going back and reading those things, it can be hard, but
yeah,
still rewarding.
Good for you though. I mean, because that's not easy to go back and face those things, you know. It's really like
the demons.
Facing trauma and stuff is really difficult. Mm-hmm. It's not a common trait for us to kind of put ourselves back through the crucible to understand ourselves better and stuff. So that's good. Yeah, because it can be very complicated, but
extremely. I have a huge plethora of books on trauma if you want those as well. They're also fantastic.
Oh man.
Another thing I love to read on. So I'll send you a whole list.
Oh, okay. That sounds horrible.
You're like, nope.
One part terror, three parts good stuff. That's usually what I'll do.
One part terror is, I feel like, necessary for every situation in life.
Yeah. Well, I have, so for a minute there, I was like really addicted to listening to real crime, true crime podcasts. Mm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh God, it was too much. I was like,
yep.
I just felt horrible. Like I was so
addicted to it. There's a feeling that comes with it.
Yeah,
yes.
It was horrible. I was like, because these are people, and like that's a mom, and that's like a sister, and that's a
these are people's
husband,
lives,
you know? And it's like, man, they just died the most gruesome way, and it's so dark. There's a podcast that's incredibly well done. Like it's really, really good.
Which one?
It's called Case Files, I think it's what it's called.
Oh, I think maybe I listened to one of these, because I also got into a weird rabbit hole with this. Hold on. Case Files. There was also Criminal. I don't know if you've not gotten to Criminal, which is pretty good.
Oh, no, I can't do it.
But don't do it, because I had to take a break as well.
Yeah. It's too much.
Well, it was funny because I feel like you know, we were working, it's so funny, at work at Elastic, we were working on The Alienist, and then we had all these other crime shows coming in. I was also really into books like Helter Skelter, or there's one called People Who Eat Darkness, all these like very, very true crime sort of retelling of horrific things, but also the psychology behind it. And so I was really into it because I'm like, oh, the way these people think, and it's really fascinating. And also how we all can relate at the same time to these kind of insane behaviors of these humans. But I got too far into that rabbit hole. We kept getting jobs. I not only was like listening to podcasts that were all about this and reading books all about this, but then all of my jobs were about this. So it was just prevalent across every single spectrum of my life. And I'm like, yeah, I need to take a break. Like, yeah. I enjoy it to a certain degree, but at the same time, I was also having, it was kind of affecting me, definitely.
Yeah. It's horrible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It gets in your psyche. I would imagine also for being a woman too, it's like, cause as a guy, it's like, wow, like this is brutal. Like, it's very rare that it's a guy that gets killed too. And so it's like, oh, and I have a daughter and I'm like, oh man, this is,
oh yeah, no, the minute you have kids, it's like, no, yeah. Immediately. No.
Yeah. I was like, man, I should have her listen to this, but I was like, nah,
no, just teach her jujitsu, teach her Krav Maga. She'll be great. She'll be so good.
She doesn't want to learn that though. But I'm like, oh no. It. So now you got to listen to this podcast then. Yeah. Then you'll have motivation. Yeah. It's pretty gnarly. Yeah. But that, the case file one, it has a, There's one called The Box, or the something like
The Box. File. I'm writing it down right now.
Let me find this episode. And so the box, it's brutal. It's super, super brutal. It's called The Toy Box. There's one and
the
two parts.
The Toy Box.
Yeah. It's so gnarly, like horrible. Mm. Yeah. Super.
And just
horrible.
The name of it is giving me weirdness.
Have fun with that, everybody. Just warning, like it's brutal. And when I listened to it, I was like, I could like I could see turning this into a film or a show or something. It's so it's so wild that it doesn't feel real, and it's just really gnarly. I always think like, what, I and something that I think a lot about more now than ever is like, what is it that happens in somebody's mind where they just go into that realm? You know, and it's like, it's so, do we all have it, and when does it trigger? Oof. And it's like, wow,
yeah,
like
you're opening up the box. That I love that box, and that was partially why I was so much into that book, The Alienist. Yes, it's fiction, but the whole idea is that there's, and this is an idea that I love, is that to some degree, we're all technically the same. You know, at the end of the day, like, we're all human, we're all sort of making the same mistakes, but then we have these special cases that make these choices that sometimes feel monstrous or foreign to us. But what's also interesting about that is if you track back people's lives and just what they themselves have been through, whether that be trauma, whether that be like certain sort of events that might happen to sort of trigger different things within them, I think there's like usually a traceable line to sort of like how these people become who they are and make the choices they're making. And if you go back to the beginning, it's not so far removed from the rest of us.
Yeah.
And the other commentary on that would be that as a society, like, what are we doing as a society to sort of encourage these behaviors and to also develop that in other people? I mean, like, we love to pretend that there's these monsters in the world and they're out there to get us. But at a lot of times, because of our society, we've created them.
Yeah. They're inside
degree.
Of us in a sense. Yeah. We all have it. That's what I think. It's a weird threshold. And I totally agree. And I find it really fascinating because I'm like, you know, you put a certain person in the right situation. I think that's what that Purge movie was supposed to do, but it just didn't do it.
Didn't. Yep.
It's horrible. Because horrible. Yeah.
Because horrible. Yeah.
And it's like, that kind of the idea of like a hybrid state of like extreme madness, basically. But I think like, yeah, it's, because if you trace back, if you go back even in this country and you kind of go back to like the Wild West era and you kind of and you really kind of get into that, there was some gnarly stuff happening back then. Obviously, there's been gnarly stuff happening back in the Khan regime. Like, there's, it's just in our nature, I think, but it's really crazy. And I think that's why like true crime is so like prevalent and thriving in the culture, because we're like, whoa, that's me almost. Because really great shows and great movies, all it is it's doing a psychological mirror on you. And it's like, hey, how much of you are you watching and what are you experiencing? Yeah.
It sort of puts a mirror up to us and society. And I think we can't help but look into it. I mean, that I think that's also why Black Mirror has done so well, because it did that with technology. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's clever too. Like, I mean, some of the episodes hit harder than others for me. Like the second season has like White Rabbit's up there. It's the entire history of you. Be Right Back. Like those episodes are insane. Like they're so well done, and they just tap into that weird kind of thing that I think is on in all of our minds. We're just unaware because the algorithms of these geniuses making these, like, you know, the dopamine drips, you know, like, oh yeah. Like, and then when we see what it is from afar, we're like, wow, super dirty. Yeah. Super gross.
It's good to look at though.
Yeah, no, it is. But it's like, yeah, I mean, that's obviously an extreme. So it's like you're swinging from one side of the branch to the other. So like,
oh yeah.
But it's really entertaining though. Like Black Mirror, I remember, I don't know, I've been talking about Black Mirror forever on this show. I think I saw like episode one and I was like, oh, this is a good show. This is crazy. Like, I can't believe the pig fucker one is insane. It's so good.
Entirely. Yeah. Well, it was so funny because I remember, it's one of those things where I still remember we had a friend here, one of our Israeli friends was here. He was just in town and he'd recently, I don't know where he'd been, but somehow he'd seen Black Mirror. I think it was in the UK first. Mm-hmm. So he's like, you have to watch the show. And I don't think it was. Yeah. And so we went, we did not download, but we might've downloaded and we watched it. And I remember just being the same experience of just like, oh, this is really interesting. This commentary and whoever is deciding to make this and giving it the go ahead, like this is good.
Yeah. It's very progressive.
It's funny.
Yeah.
Yes.
I always tell people when they watch, like if you ever listen or if you ever are going to watch Black Mirror, don't watch the first episode, like watch the second one and then go through that. If you can handle those and you like those, then go to one. I just think
then go back.
I have so much like, I'm like so much props to that entire team for like, let's put that one first. Let's just see. And like, wow, what a ballsy move. Because even my father-in-law, like I was like, oh, you like this kind of stuff? I was like, you should watch Black Mirror. And I forgot to tell him that. And he was like, I can't believe you told me to watch that. And he like went off about it. I'm like, man, you could have turned it off. He's like, I did it. And then I watched the other ones and I like those ones, but I don't like that one. Why did you tell me to watch them? I'm like, man, you're definitely old enough to like handle your own like judgments here. So
no, I have to tell you, Ash, sometimes people are never old enough to handle some of that stuff.
That's
like
true.
They can't, they just can't. Like age does not mean that you're able to handle it.
No, dang it. Yeah. And I have
some
problems.
You'd hope, but no.
I'm just as guilty. So yeah, I can't point the finger of judgment. So
no, well, I had those moments. Cause I remember the first time, did you ever see Irreversible?
Irreversible? I think I did. Let's see.
I'm trying to remember. Is that Gus Van Sant or is that Gaspar?
Oh, it's that. Oh yes. I've seen.
Oh, it is Gaspar. It's Gaspar.
Yeah. No. It's Gaspar. No. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't seen that. I've seen the other one, Enter the Void, I think.
Enter the Void was crazy. Well, Irreversible, and this is one of those things just to tie into your telling someone to watch someone, but probably should not have told them to watch it.
Oh, yeah.
I saw it years ago when I was still living in Utah, and it was just a random, you know, I used to go to, we had one movie theater that would play these kind of shows where it was okay. Like Utah bans a lot of films. So you generally will miss a lot of stuff, especially back in the 90s and the 2000s, of course in the 80s. So this was the one theater where you could go and kind of get a taste for what was happening in foreign cinema. So I would go a lot of times by myself because there weren't a lot of people interested to join me. And I remember just rolling up to the theater randomly to watch this. And I could not move from my seat. Like I was stuck there watching this narrative unfold that was horrific. And also I couldn't look away from, but also the film techniques were incredible. It was something I'd never seen before in my entire life. And it left this impression on me that just was, it's almost like a little bit traumatic to watch it. But at the same time, I kept thinking about the filmmaking techniques. And then later I remember I was staff at Motion Theory. And one of my friends came up to me and he's like, oh, we were just talking about different kind of films we like, and they were sort of all in this vein of a little bit like hard to watch and sort of a commentary on society in some way. So I suggested the film, not knowing he was going to watch it with his wife.
Oh no!
And he came. Yes, exactly. He came back the next day, and he's like, "Why? Why did you tell me to watch this? Because there's quite literally like a 10-minute rape scene in the middle of it. Jeez. Spoiler alert. So, and it is like
sounds
it does
amazing.
Not, it's amazing. So he was just up in arms about it, and I was just like, "Oh, okay, yeah. If I'd known the entire audience that was watching this with you, I would not have suggested it. But it's a hard film."
Yeah, I think it's, his movies are heavy. And I always tell people that too. I'm like, okay, well, like what I always go like, what other movies have seen like this, you know? And then they're like, oh, I'm like, yeah, you're probably not going to like this. So,
yeah. Well, and it's funny because I feel like with his films and also with, I'm forgetting his name. Is it Lars? Who does the other stuff? Who did,
Lars von Trier?
Yes.
Like Antichrist and stuff?
Yes, exactly. So these two, it's like this is when I get into a conversation about like, when is it too much? Do you know what I mean? And I don't just mean like the abuse of the actors in the case of Lars's films, but it's more like how much pain can we handle when we're watching something? And like how much abuse can we take as an audience when we're sort of witnessing these films? And there's, for me, those two really are the people who go over, filmmakers that go way over the line sometimes, where it's like, okay, this is too much abuse for me as a viewer, and probably for many people as a viewer. And then I think there's other people who are fine with it, but it's hard to watch.
Yeah, it's kind of like a weird fetish thing, I think. It's like there's a weird kind of thing that happens when watching that. You kind of live like a weird voyeuristic kind of fantasy.
Yeah.
And so for those films, if you don't feel like shit after, then you got a weird problem, I think. Because you should feel like crap. But you should, I mean, also as a creative person, be like, wow, that's really like, that was revolutionary, like how they approached that. But yeah, like I have a real hard time watching those movies, to be honest. I'm like, dude, this is so brutal. But I also, I try my best to never like judge art that way. Like I try not to be like, I'm fucking, that's not art, whatever. Because art is everything, you know. It's like it's just up to you, whatever you want it to be, you know. So I try not to. It's all judgment, you know. So, but with their art, it's so raw. And if their actors are willing to do it, then I have no place in saying anything, really. To be honest, it's like if they're all willing to make that happen, then. Well, that's their thing. And I simply don't have to watch it. That's the power I can give to that, you know? So
it's a great point. It's a fantastic point. And I think I do as well get caught up in that being like, but I'll come out of a film. I'll be like, this is crap. Like this is straight garbage. Like who would watch this?
Oh, I do because, that too.
Yes. It's just because like I am reacting to it so emotionally that sometimes I'm just completely discrediting it. But to go there as creatives, like I do have so much respect for people who are able to kind of do these really intense examinations of human nature in a completely uncomfortable way, because at some point, like in the story of me telling you about watching Irreversible, it does affect people. And I think, you know, I'm not one to say on like what art should or should not do, but I think it's really, it's always good to make people feel something.
Yeah. Yeah. You should, you know, and I think it's like when you watch a Disney, sorry for cutting you off. I didn't mean to, but I just got excited.
Oh, you're not at all.
to add an exclamation point that cuts off the last letter of your word. But I really think it's really like, I mean, I really adore like Pixar films when they're done well. Like they're really well crafted stories of joy, usually, or like a weird, interesting kind of thing, you know. So, but yeah, like in the opposite spectrum, you have like Lars von Trier and Gaspar Noé, who are like really pushing you in your mind to another place. And I think that they're both very relevant, but I guess it just depends on what you want to eat at the platter, you know, like what do you want to eat? The world is yours. And what are you trying to eat and why are you trying to eat it? I think that's usually what I try to ask myself is like, why do I like the things that I like besides nostalgia and moments of time? Like, I'm like, why did I binge watch Mindhunter? You know? And there's a lot of reasons why, you know, but like, I'm also fascinated by stuff. Cause I'm like, whoa, like, am I a killer too? It's weird. You know, like, are we all like, this is weird.
Yes.
You know?
We're all at the end of it.
I think like, well, I think, I don't know if everybody has the potential to kill, like I'll go through it completely, but I think we all have potential to do so. when I was younger, I wanted to go. I was like, I was kind of hell bent on going into like military or something like that. I was really interested in that. I was like, I guess I was a little patriotic, but I was more or less like, I just didn't like the idea of like evil people in the world. And I was like, I got to take those fuckers out of here, man. And that's such a horrible thought, you know, like, because who am I to say that, to judge that person? But I mean, I guess, yeah, I guess we can judge. So
that's also like a product of like, one, how you were raised and also our society. Like I grew the way I grew up was the same. I mean, so many people, like one of my good friends I've known for years and I love him. Like we would have these debates about right versus wrong or black versus white. Mm-hmm. And the world we grew up in, because we were raised Mormon in Utah and most everybody for the most part was Mormon at that time. Yeah. There were very clear delineations of good versus evil and like the narratives around good versus evil. And it created this psychology within each of us where we would view the world in black and white. So he was the same. Like he was very much like he wanted to join the army. He wanted to do like black ops. He wanted to be those people who were like, you know, killing the evil humans in the world. Yeah. And we would get to debates about like what that meant. Like who, like when we're talking about evil people, quote, what does that mean? And like it's just a perspective we all have differently, you know.
Yes.
But that's not because he. Yeah, he wasn't born that way, though. That was like bred into us because of how we were raised.
Yeah,
so it totally makes sense. It's complete programming.
Yeah. And once I started to really acknowledge that and understand that about myself, I was like, oh, yeah, like a lot of this is just how I was raised in a sense of programming. Mm-hmm. But that's weird because my mom, I was just raised by a single mom. She wasn't like, yeah, get them, you know, like that was never a part of it. It was, I think it was a lot of like, Jean-Claude Van Damme movies or something. I don't know what it was.
Yes,
you know?
But again, and that's the society thing because everything was so like, think about like films in the 80s. There was always like the good guys and the bad guys. The bad guys were always weirdly terrorists. Do you know what I mean? That were dressed very like racist way.
Yeah, they were. Like, especially back then.
We were sort of, we were fed and told who the good guys girl were and who the bad guys were. And it creates, it's not just your family, but it's also like what we're seeing in society, which gets back to, you know, what are we doing as creators and filmmakers to like set the precedent for what we think of the world. And and with that, I kind of think about, you know, I don't know if you've been watching Euphoria that came out on HBO.
No, let's see, Euphoria. I've heard about it.
I think I was hesitant to watch it because I was thinking if this is some kind of high school drama or whatever, I don't want to get into that, like a Riverdale thing. It's just not my thing.
Yeah.
But what I love about Euphoria is it creates a different narrative, not only for stereotypes of people in high school, but also stereotypes of gender and also the experience of those people. And I think it's so nice to see these different creators and filmmakers making these different narratives that aren't quite so clear cut of good versus evil, or this is what the world's like. It's sort of opening up the palette for everybody who gets to watch it.
Mm, that's great. I love those. I mean, it's time for those narratives to be shown and presented, you know, like I love watching films that come from different perspectives because I'm like, wow, that's really interesting, you know, because for a very long time inside of popular culture, we're seeing a lot of the same narrative because it's coming from the same source, you know, so it's always interesting, fascinating, whether I like it or agree with it. That's another topic. But like, I also think it's, I mean, I'm not supposed to agree with it. I'm supposed to be shook by it, you know, but I guess it's your pain tolerance and your threshold for desire of growth, you know, so. And not everybody wants that. Some people want to go like, you know what, like life. I think a lot of people that kind of don't want to face these things are the ones that have to deal with it the most, because I think that they escape because it's so heavy. It's so much noise. Yeah. And so I sympathize with that most. So that's why I like when people are like resisting change, I'm like, well, you know what, like you have to want it and I'm not going to force it on you. And it's the same thing kind of like, you're mentioning not being preachy about eating animals and stuff. It's the same thing. You have to, like to be a really good vegetarian or vegan, like, cause I have friends that are really preachy and I'm like, you know, I just tell them like, hey, you know what? Shut the fuck up, man.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You sound like
it's
a piece
just
of
pushing
shit.
You away. Yeah. It's not good. You can't be preachy. And it's the same. Like I get a little wrapped up in, it's so funny. A few of my friends at work, they love to say that, I have a ledger, and the ledger is like the book I open up when I feel like people need to like open their mind, and I like write their name down. But essentially I do get a little wrapped up when I feel like people are being a bit too close-minded in how they view gender and how they view like people's sexuality and their preference. And then like, I kind of go on tirades, but that's, you know, I'm just making it worse. You know what I mean? Like everybody has their own, like you're saying, like level of pain tolerance or what they're willing to kind of, it's like baby doses, right? Like with my father, for example, he's like a Trump supporter. He's like an older white man. And I think it's hard for him to accept all the changes that have happened in society. Sure. But I think if I'm not like just yelling at him and trying to convince him otherwise, and things sort of, he takes things in little tiny baby doses that are acceptable for him so that he can kind of start to, you know, it's like when you put a lobster in the water and you just slowly turn up the heat.
Yeah, that's a good guy. I put your dad in the water. Your dad's a lobster.
Put him in the water.
Yeah.
He's lobster. We're going to like slowly cook him up, but it's like slow immersion. So he's not like shocked, but that's something like I have to be better about not getting so up in arms about trying to change people's minds or forcing people into open-mindedness or forcing them. Yeah. It's not worth it. I'm making it worse as well.
Yeah. You're actually becoming a wall to put up.
Yes.
Yeah. And then that's the thing that's really interesting about politics and all that stuff. Like, was recently with some really close relatives and friends and family. And one of them, I had worked on this film called The Great Hack. And it's about like how this Cambridge Analytica company like used all this Facebook data and like sold it to these politicians to like manipulate people with propaganda and all this shit.
Horrifying.
Yeah. Super horrifying and maniacal and all, and at the same time, incredibly effective and used really well. Like, unfortunately, I'm not a political person, so I don't really talk about it. I don't watch the news. I don't pay attention. My wife makes me vote, and she tells me who the people are. And I'm like, because come voting week, I'm like, okay, who is the people? And I do like a synopsis. And it's so hard because everybody's views are so different, you know, and everybody's so polarized. So I'm like, man. So when I like for the Hillary Trump thing, I'm like, wow, they both fucking suck, you know, like, but let's get picking one evil over the other, you know, it's really dire. Like, it wasn't like when Obama was coming through and like, oh, this guy's really about change and wanting to do some interesting things and like, wanting to kind of equalize the playing field and help people out that need it. And I was like, okay, I'm down for that. But yeah, it was really weird. But I was having a conversation after with somebody that we were watching the movie with, and she's like, she really does not like Trump at all. And you know, I don't care. It's her thing. And, but she was going off about stuff, and I was like, yeah, but do you know that's true? And she was like, well, and she was like, cause I was questioning her ability to understand what is the truth and not. And then she got was like pointing her finger and standing up at me. And I'm like, wow, like, you lost to me. Like, I have zero respect for you right now. Cause it's gross. Like, when you yell and point and yell, like, it's like, ugh. Yeah.
Well, we all become the same thing, right? Like, I think we love to create sides, right? We're like, oh, everybody on the right, Trump supporters, et cetera, they're also, exactly. It does become team sports. Politics is complete team sports. Yeah. So, and that's the mentality that I think has gotten us where we are now, unfortunately. I think now we are all so angry and divided because it is a team sports and because we just look at, you know, a tagline and sort of like fully agree to it. But the truth of it is that there's, you know, this is like shades of gray. Do you know what I mean? When we're talking about truth and when we talk about facts and we talk about what's actually going on, there is no clear cut answer. And I think that's what's so hard and unacceptable for people is that whether it's in politics, whether it's about like who they are as people, is that sometimes there's not a clear answer. There are facts, but that doesn't immediately give you an answer. I mean, you have to find that for yourself. So I get into this with my father and my family because we feel very differently about things. I get into it with my friends, but it's just good to re-examine like why, like when an emotion is coming up as you're in these conversations, like if I'm talking about politics with somebody in my family and I'm getting highly emotional, that's a good moment for me to kind of look at that. What is causing the high emotion? Is it just because of like some ingrained core belief that I feel like is threatened? Like, am I afraid in this moment? Like, why am I so upset?
Good.
Because generally that's when the conversation goes awry, is when the emotions get high and it's just like hijacking. Intense. Like,
you're not entirely a human anymore. You're just kind of your blob of emotions and you're like, oh
yeah,
you're not an evolved human. Basically,
it's
what happens.
It's never good. It's never good.
Cause it's both ways. And that's why it's so weird. And that's why you have these polar shifts, because it's like a pineal thing. Like it's a lizard brain kind of thing that happens. And it's like, it's
usually lizard brain.
Yeah. It's a fear based kind of thing that happens. And it's like, oh damn, you know? And it's, when that happens, it's like, oh wow. Like it's so trivial and weird. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's an unfortunate thing, but I think it's also really good because we're supposed to have polar opposites of thought and consideration. And like your dad's point of view on the world is his world, mm-hmm. respectfully. And like, and unless he's hurting people, then it's like, well, that's what he's doing. And that's, he should have that ability. And your view is something different. It's almost like, it's like a lesson that I learned very early on. Never talk about religion or politics with somebody unless you're willing to go into that and be ready for it. You know?
Yes.
So I've had horror stories getting into that stuff.
I think we all have. And it's funny. It's escalated, you know, like,
yeah, I don't know. It's a weird thing because of the climax. I think it's always been weird. Like I get this conversation a lot with my friends and we have a group of friends. We talk really deep about life and just everything. And one of the things is like, oh, like one of our friends would be like, man, it's so dark and bad these days. I'm like, yes, it's really not. It's not at all. Like, do a little bit of research. Look at the Black Plague. Just research the Black Plague. Just do that only. And you're going to realize how incredibly epic the era we live in is. Really great. I think the problem is, and the way I look at it is, if you're on the internet on the right, on the wrong spots of the internet, you're inundated with shit. Like you're just basically like shoving shit into your face and it's really unhealthy. So I cut all that shit out because it's like, yeah, it's not doing anything good for me. And it's making me more upset about things that I just really can't control. But what I can control is my world and my own family. I can't control them, but I can help navigate these things. You know, like I definitely can't control my 14-year-old daughter. I'm trying to, but I can't. Oh, no. She's going to do whatever she wants.
You gotta let that one go.
Yeah.
Not entirely, just a little bit.
Yeah.
But this is sort of about like creating our own palettes. Like here's what I find to be wonderful about like social media and like the age we live in currently, where everything is readily available, is that you can, there's so many times when I was young that I wished I'd had the internet in order to just like reality base, in order to just like Google something, because like what I was being fed from the circle I was raised in was really just one worldview. And so there's something incredible about being able to really kind of see what is going on around the world. Mm. However, at the same time, there's that trap, like you're talking about, that we all fell in, where it's like, if you are just going onto Facebook and you have friends who feel only one way and you're trapped in one bubble of political thinking or religious thinking, or if you on your Instagram are only looking at, oh, I had a friend who, she was constantly looking at people's like lifestyle photography. And in a way where it's like they were just these, you know, like Insta famous people who had incredible looking, incredible curated, beautiful looking lives. And she was so depressed, but it was not real.
No, it's all fucking fake.
And we had this conversation thinking it's real. Exactly. But it's given to you in a way where you start to like sort of believe the myth. You start to like eat those lies and assume that like there's something wrong with you and you're less than. But it's the same with politics. Like if you're only eating that garbage, like you're talking about, you're going to feel like garbage all the time.
Yeah. And the thing with the Instagram and the algorithms, it is what you give it. So if you're constantly liking the same shit, you're putting it in a cycle and it's just feeding you back that
stuff.
It's going
to feed it back to you. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is technology.
Yeah. You got to basically every month you should cut it all out, like cut out as much as you can. Yep. And just remove it. I mean, you got to ask yourself when you're doing this, okay, am I doing this without knowing I'm doing it? That's a problem. It's like a cigarette or something. Like, and let's say
it's an addiction.
And like, if you sit down to use the restroom, you're like, okay, I'm going to put it on Instagram. Okay, well, that's a weird thing. If you're using it and like before you know it, your feet are asleep and you're like, what the hell am I doing here? It's because you've been
I feel like it's such a thing that everybody does now. It's 100%. Just like hiding in the bathroom for hours looking at like, social media, Instagram, whatever. It's so hilarious.
Because it's a brilliant design. You have to hand it to the people that made it because it's brilliantly made. It's really, really well made. And it's designed to do that. It's designed to keep you in a cycle so they can sell you shit that you don't need, really. That's pretty much what it is. And if you can really accept that and understand it, you can know what it is. And I try to use this stuff as tools and that's it. I don't like, I mean, I'm very blessed because I've designed a life that I really enjoy. And I've kind of manifested a reality that I enjoy, like for the most part. And so my reality isn't bad. So I don't need to escape. You know what I'm saying? So because I'm able to do that, and because I'm able to enjoy my life. But it's, I could see this being really difficult if I would, like, if you take me back when I was like maybe like a teenager and stuff. It's really like when I watch my daughter use it, I'm like, wow, like, am I a bad parent for like letting her use this stuff? And it's like, well, it's like, it's almost like I couldn't not let her because it's where everything exists for her, like, generation and stuff. So so
it's hard. It's hard to, like, I'm really interested to see like what studies I would hope they're doing currently that would relate to how teens psychologically, and there's been some that came out, but just like hormonally, we're just different people when we're young adults, you know, as teens, and to like see how that, the effect of like instant gratification and social media and immediately interacting and immediately getting feedback, like what that's doing to their minds, really, like as we kind of go forward as a society.
Yeah. I think we all kind of want to have instant, you know, things, and it's not a bad desire to have, but it's also really bad to think that that's a reality. That's the real key. It's something that I try to explain to my daughter through actions rather than words. So I just hope they register, but she probably won't come back around to me telling me these things until she's like 25. And I'm on a 9-year kind of period here. I'm just going to, I'm going to sit here and just kind of deal with this and see what happens. So
The self-reflection is going to come later, but I'm sure it will be very rewarding when you hear it from her.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm like, I told you so. But it's interesting. But I mean, I think that's the interesting part of the journey of being a human, really, you know? But I really think like that's one thing. I had a paradigm shift inside my mind where I was like, yeah, we're all wrong and we're all right. And it's okay to judge, but at the same time, it's not. And it's important to kind of see the other side. Like, why do people side with this kind of thought and really kind of not empathize or be preachy at all? Just kind of go like, why are they doing that? That's interesting. Like, I could see that. That makes sense. Cause if you think about like the propaganda that was spilled onto like the Trump thing, it was like, you know, we want to keep our jobs and we want to keep our country and people safe. Like, these are all things that we all want, but they're half truths. You know, that's the thing. And you have to look at it beyond that, I think, and see what's going on, you know? So, and the health of everybody, because if us as a country thrive, if everybody in our country is thriving, education's good and people are well taken care of, like, then everybody is well. Not if like, hey, the top 2% are doing great and everybody, no, it's not how that works at all. And
it's so true.
It's a simple understanding of like common economics and stuff, but most people don't have that threshold for reality, and that's nothing against them. It's just that they never really consider that thought outside their own bubble. So, but
it's completely true. Yeah. I mean, it's like we all get better together. Do you know what I mean? I think it's, we sort of forget these things. And I think, you know, the minute that we play with tactics, especially politics, when they start to speak to the country's fears, which is kind of like this fear of being alone and this fear of dying alone and this fear of losing your job and this fear of not being relevant. I mean, these are all really basic human emotions. Like, we all feel this. And I think that we're all reacting a bit too emotionally.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like we've reached a place where politics has just turned into speaking to us on like a very core, raw emotional level, and we are all responding in kind.
Yeah.
And it's kind of pure chaos at the moment, but what you're saying is right. Like, we have to, we're better all together. Like, we get well as a society, not trying to convince other people, but like when we're just towards a better good, like we all have the same basic needs. We should just be working towards those.
Yes. Yes. And we should share that. We should share the bounty of that. It is really hard. I can totally see that. And I see and understand because I've been on spectrum. So I understand, like, you know, the desire to not want to share, or the jealousy or the rage or the insecurities. I mean, to go back to kind of what we do for a living, because I know this conversation's all over the place. Sorry to the listeners. Yeah, you thought you're here about art and photography? Yeah.
Nope.
Good luck. Yeah.
We're going to talk about politics. We're going to talk about how your childhood was rough.
Yeah. But if we talk about like what we do, like the things that we do, like, there's a lot of ego involved, I would imagine, you know, like, do you think that there's ego when you go into create your work?
I mean, it would be, I will relate the idea of ego is like, if I were to tell you that there's no ego when I'm working on things or that I just don't have an ego, it's like me pretending as a society, like we're not racist. At the core of all of us, there is some racism. At the core of like our society, there's racism. And I think it's the same with ego. Like the dream is to be like, no, I have no ego. Like I'm not one of those egotistical maniacs who like walks into a job and needs things, but there's levels. And I think like you're saying with creativity, it's really hard to kind of tamp that down and not sort of take things personally or feel like you own something. And ownership has a plus side and a downside. But for me, I feel like what's made it so wonderful to kind of step away from ownership and step away from being too controlling is when things are more collaborative. Mm. And I find that I thrive really well with that. I mean, don't get me wrong. Collaboration can be like the bane of existence for me.
Yeah.
It can be so hard and it can be such a struggle, but at the same time, when things are a bit more collaborative, I find that it enhances my creativity. It enhances my learning on a project, and it just can really create really rewarding outcomes in the end.
Yeah, well, I think it's all about the collaborator, you know. That's and how you're
entirely.
Because if you have a collaborator that's the same as you, it's usually not going to go well, because you have all that you're explaining and showing all your traits. So you're like, what the fuck? I hate that part about myself. But then you don't know it, and you're like, like that person sucks. And you're like, well, it's basically you. But yeah, that's what I found. Like, I found that for me, it's like it all comes down to the right collaborator and really deeply like. Unlike not even using words to communicate things. And it's because like, especially when it comes to creativity, it's like another form of language. So you really want to have like that on point, you know? So, which is really, it's really, it all comes for me, at least it comes down to that, but yeah, absolutely. Ego is everywhere. It's, I was reading a book called Ego is the Enemy, I think something like that. And it was hard for me to read. Because I was like, fuck, like I'm an egomaniac, you know, like, but at the same time, like, well, it's just kind of who I am, I guess, you know? So it's not, I'm not an egomaniac. Maybe I am, I don't know. But when I was reading, I was like, this sucks. I'm having a hard time reading this, you know? Cause but I was like, is this true or not? You know, it was like,
that is
good.
So good though. That's so good that you were reading this thing and sort of one relating to it, but then also able to have perspective on it. Because I think the fault with ego comes when you're unaware of it, when you are unaware of how controlling you're being or how micromanaging or whatever you're doing, that's so wrapped up in your own ego. That's when it's dangerous. But if you're aware of it and you can see these things that you're doing, I mean, I see it when I'm doing it and I'm being a full control freak, or when I just refuse to change an idea because I'm absolutely positive that this is the best way to do it. You're aware of it, you know, you're really still having a moment of self-examination and knowing it. And I think that's when it's okay. You know,
I learned that from Alcoholics Anonymous is that, well, I'm not an alcoholic and I didn't go to it, but when I moved out and I was on my own, moved out around 14 and I lived in a house that, was with a bunch of sponsored like alcoholics basically. Cause my grandfather had a house and he would have all these people that he would sponsor come and live in the house that I was living in.
Oh, wow.
So I was around that a lot at a very young age. And the thing that I learned from them is like the moment that you acknowledge that you have a problem is the moment that you're willing to move forward towards growth. And so, the acknowledgement is really key. And it's very important to go like, hey, like, I have a problem here with the way I think about things and stuff too. So, and I think it's kind of a rare thing to constantly be willing to put yourself down in a sense, like not unhealthily, but like go like, look, I could be better, you know, like, I think that comes from a place of like, when you know, like last night it was pretty interesting. I had jiu-jitsu and my coach is finally back in town. He was Gio. He was out in Dublin, Ireland. And he was in the UK and he finally came back and I was like, I'm very close with him. And I was like, how's your trip and everything? And then he was like, I just feel good to be back. And then the gym was like 100 degrees and he was like, okay guys, like usually when we do these rounds of, when we do live like jiu-jitsu, like we'll do like 7 minute rounds, but he's like, we're doing 10 minute rounds. And I was like, God, I love that, because he came back and he was like, I got to beast through it. And I was thinking to myself, the reason why he's like top three in the world is because he has that way of knowing that he's going to put in the hard work and the benefit of winning, the benefit of like not winning physically, but like winning in the mind state of a high level person. It's like he he understands the benefits of succeeding, basically, because he knows the hard work leads to the success. And that's a hard thing to really put into people. It's like, no, like, you're not even there yet. You have to go further. And like, no, you're still not there yet. You have to go further than you even have, you've ever understood about yourself. And that's a real hard thing to do. Yeah. And I see a lot of complacency and people frustrated. So when it comes to doing your work, I really for sure want to talk about your work and your photography as well, especially because I'm sorry we were segue, but
I love segues. My life is segues.
Okay,
let's just talk about everything else but that
random stuff. Okay, yeah, because I mean, before I do podcasts, I will do like, I'll write out a bunch of like random questions and topics and stuff, and I have it's cool. I really love the way the conversation's gone, but like I definitely forgot to ask you some certain specifics, so, which is fine if we don't get to if that's okay. Yeah. So, but when it comes to when you're working, like the ratio, do you find yourself learning new things or like a program per se, if that's more too specific, or is there like a certain trait about your approach to things that you're kind of like, oh, I had this thought of this thing and I wanted to try this thing, or I was inspired by this one like classic photographer to try this thing. What's your ratio normally like?
I feel like every project is kind of a new discovery, both in terms of inspiration, a point of reference. I feel like depending on if I have collaborators on it with me, this might be why I love doing what I do so much right now, is because it's constantly changing me as a human. Like, I feel like I'm getting better as a person, like as I go through these creative projects. And don't get me wrong, like there's some projects where it's like, I've got 2 weeks to make like an end tag, and that's, you know, I'm probably not going to gain some sort of personal growth from that per se. But I feel like some of these larger projects that come in that are sort of, projects of love and devotion, when I start to get involved on it, it is kind of a matter of always trying something new. And that's something that I love, is I don't want to be recycling something we've done in the past or I've done in the past. I want to try a new technique. Maybe it's something, I'm so not a technical person, but sometimes it might be technical. And in that case, I do have somebody who's a far more technical savvy collaborator with me
of course.
To teach me as I go. But like, I love being completely uncomfortable in new sort of creative situations. And so I think that's what keeps me interested. And that's really what fuels me to keep going.
Good for you. That's a real hard thing to do. Constantly feel like shit. Yeah. It sucks. It gets old. Yeah.
It's hard, right? So then it's like, and this might be why I also love being freelance, is there's breaks. I really love to take breaks after sometimes like a very difficult project.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing too is like, I have so many projects where the end product, you know, maybe it's usually not what I necessarily envisioned it would be, which is a good thing and a bad thing. And a lot of times it's not entirely executed like in the perfect way, but it's more that whole middle section of the creative process and what takes place and transpires during the discovery of what this project is going to look like. That section is like my favorite part. That's the bit where I love it. And when I feel like there's not enough time for that middle section, it really takes away from the enjoyment and the pleasure of the project, which, as we both know, with timelines and deadlines in this industry, sometimes there isn't a lot of room for that middle section.
Yeah. It's really rare to have that. Because I've been doing freelance, I try to navigate this. This is actually probably touching on some weird questions that I would get. And when it comes to freelance, I try to navigate the situation so that I can have moments like that. So I try to control the expectations of the client at the end so that I can kind of go like, you don't know it, but the best thing about us collaborating is me having that time. And because you're going to get what you're asking for, which is like something unique and something thought provoking and something that's catching and all that kind of stuff. And the only way to do that is to have deep thought and deep thinking and to go in there, and you have to go in there. And that's, you know, I learned this a lot from Anthony, my friend Anthony Scott Burns. Like he doesn't work like I do or most people do that I know of. He's like, he'll go on like long walks and like he won't work on something for like a week or something. He'll think about it. He doesn't do that normally, but he'll think about it.
I love it.
And then he'll go like into the computer and boom, it's done. And he's like just beasted right through it, like super quick, super fast. And it's like,
that's amazing.
Yeah. It's a different process too. Like the way that he works. Like, I think that's probably one of the biggest, I think the things that I love the most about being a freelancer is because mm-hmm. I can kind of dictate who I work with and how I work with them and all that kind of stuff. But it's so, it's so like, that was a word the other day. I was thinking like, it's if you do this, you have to be prepared to be like nothing stable. It's like always in flux, and it's quite taxing, to be honest.
We're like gypsies. We're little like industry gypsies.
Yeah, it's weird because I'm like a habitual person. Like if I go to a restaurant and I try like a dish that's really good, I'm like, yeah, I'm just gonna have that every time I come here. Like I don't care.
Yeah, it's probably extra difficult on you because I'm sort of like, it's like my subconscious is just constantly embracing chaos. So this is fine.
Oh, okay. Well, sometimes it's weird because it depends on what day, like the person that I wake up with, like in my mind, yes. You know? So some days I'm like, yeah, I'm going to try all kinds of new different stuff. But then some days I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to have that because my mind is so tired. I'm just going to have that. So
entirely. Yeah. But like what you're saying though, about it being taxing and difficult is so true because not only there's so many rewards that come with it, because I think a lot of artists, especially like younger artists who are just getting into this, they don't really understand the concept of interaction with a client. And I don't mean just getting on a phone call and talking to them, but the level of education that sometimes is involved and the level of collaboration that's also involved and just like honing your communication skills. And this is something that I think you really have to take onus of when you become freelance, because you're sort of forced into it. Like you become your own tiny business.
Yes.
And these are things you have to do every single day.
Yes. Yes. I totally agree. It's a very complicated thing. Yeah. Balancing it, but at the same time, everybody has their own way of doing it too. Like, I don't know. It's something I think about a lot. Like, how does this work? And why does this work like this? And why do I do this? And for the various reasons and stuff. So, but yeah, I find it to be really rewarding though. And I think the idea is, for me at least, it's I can control the way that my life plays out, I guess, in a sense, you know, so.
Entirely, especially when you have a family. I mean, the thing is to constantly be thinking about quality of life, you know, because it's not just, you know, I remember like early on in the industry when it was just me, like this rogue, like lone person, not in a relationship and sort of young, I was just willing to do anything all the time because the only person I had to really worry about and be aware of was myself.
Yeah.
But then it's like when there's other people who rely on you and then there's other relationships you sort of like need to nurture and sort of help care for, you still have to find these spaces for that. Where previously you probably didn't need it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think families, like especially like with having kids, like ritual and routine is key for them. It's so important. And when you break that, it really kind of shatters them in a sense, you know? So,
yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I always look at like my, because that's the only example I have. I look at my childhood in comparison. I'm like, oh, okay, well, like, how does this compare to my daughter's? And it's like so different. Like,
I'm sure.
Be more different. And I'm like, wow, this is weird that I did this, you know, like out of everything. But it's also, you know, it's like, it's not just me. It's my wife's raising her and stuff too. So it's interesting though. I'm constantly thinking about like, wow, how does that work? And why does that work like that? And all that kind of stuff. It's, yeah, it's something that keeps me constantly, I guess, kind of influx of thought, I guess, as to like, cause I'm always wondering, am I doing this right? You know, I don't think so.
Are we all wondering that, Ash?
No, I don't think so.
No matter what it is. Well, okay. Like those people, I'm sorry. Those people who aren't doing that, they need to question themselves some more because like, it's so good to sort of be like, am I doing this right? And like, should I be doing this? And can I do something differently? And what would make this situation sort of not necessarily better, but just like improve overall? I think it's so good to constantly be asking those questions, not only of yourself, but you know, the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a deep thought, I guess. Yeah. It's, I'm sitting here like thinking about it, like, oh yeah, it's a really, but it's a great thought to have. I think it's an important one to have too. And it's something that I think I think it's a really powerful and important thing for creatives like ourselves to do, because we have the power to manifest, and it's so important to exercise that, you know? So I mean, I'm a big believer in that. It's like, there's no reason why a creative person should have a bad life, really, in my mind. Like, you should be able to manifest and change it. Like, if, oh, you have money problems? Well, just make it. Make money. Like, it's easy to do if you want it. Like, you just have to think it, you know? And then it happens, you know? So, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not like the blessing of it is that because we can go through these things and kind of go basically pile drive. It's not like we're harvesting a crop and we only have so much land to do. Like, no, like the crop is our minds and how far we want to take it, you know? So,
yeah. Well, and that's the hard part because sometimes there is a drought creatively.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that.
And in those situations, woof. Yeah.
Have you had droughts in your mind, like, or in your career where moments where you have felt creatively dried up or uninspired?
I mean, yeah, there's, and I don't, you know, I can't speak for the rest of us creatives, but just for me, there's moments where what I find like the hardest thing about working in this industry is that there's an expectation of needing to, especially when you're freelance, to constantly deliver at the same level, to constantly have the same quality of ideas and concepts, to constantly have the same quality of execution. And it's like, when you're a creative, that's obviously not going to be the case. Like, there's going to be a point of wavering. There's going to be some projects and some jobs that just, you know, you didn't come through on it, or you just weren't quite as inspired, or the creative process wasn't as immersive as you needed it to be for it to really come across in that fantastic way. And that's hard because even though you're aiming for consistency creatively, that's not how the creative mind works. Creative mind goes through like dips. It goes through valleys and peaks. And sometimes you're in a state of crazy creative mania where you're making like fantastic ideas and concepts. And then suddenly you dip down and there's just really nothing to pull from. And you're sort of just recycling ideas or sort of just trying to like make it happen. Yeah. But it's almost like coming to terms with that. For me, it's like knowing that there are going to be times where I just like can't pull anything out, and that's okay. And maybe I lean on things that have worked in the past, not recycling it or like redoing it entirely, but just like going back to like old methods of working to help spark the interest or spark like another idea. Yeah. But it's also knowing that sometimes that project is going to suck and your work on it is going to suck, and that's okay, you know?
Yeah, it's a habitual thing. Yeah. And it is good. It's good to acknowledge that everything. I have a thing that I was starting to say inside my mind that I was wanting to share with everybody, is like, I fail privately and I try to succeed publicly. So yes. I don't feel so horrible. But it's also, it's like I'm projecting this weird false reality almost, you know, by doing that. And it's unfortunate for people to see that, like, oh, like, this guy is doing all these things and I don't see him failing and I feel like shit because I am failing, you know? So it's like, but it's untrue to the system of art. And it is true. There is peaks and valleys. I have like tried my best and I've managed to develop and maneuver a way to just turn me into an engine, like just constantly going at a high speed. And like,
yes.
I don't know the repercussions of this. Like, I've been doing it for a long time though, and it's been working. I've only had a couple moments where I was like, oh shit, I feel horrible. But other than that, I'm like, I just keep going. I'll just sit at the desk and, because usually like people are like, well, how do you get past that? It's like, man, you just fucking sit there and do it, you know? It's like, an asshole thing to say, but it's like, it's the truth for me.
No, but persistence is a really important idea. It's not really an asshole thing to say. I feel like persistence is kind of the key, because one thing that, like, when I was a younger creative, you know, everything I made was very much tied to me emotionally and personally. And when I did have a valley and I was feeling like I was failing, there's a tendency to want to give up and just be like, throw your hands up in the air and walk away from the project. However, as professionals in our career now, that's not an option. Like, you can't be that person who just gives up because you're upset that you're failing. Like, you have to take that failure and just persistently keep like going forward with it, so that when you want to walk away and give up, you just keep at it until something comes out of it. So I think it's a really important point.
It is. I also think that rest is obviously important too, but rest is really deceiving. It'll suck you in and you'll go like, oh, like, I'm tired and I'm unmotivated today. And you're going to write your narrative as just this person that does that. And it's unfortunate. Yeah. And for me, I go like, well, I'm tired. Well, who gives a fuck? I got to get up and get it done. You know, like I was working till 5 last night. We talked about this. And then now we're doing podcasts at 10 in the morning. It's like, I committed to it. Uh-huh. We got to do it. It has to get done. And that's it. And I'm having a great time. And I'm glad that I woke up and did this. But it's all at the same time. It's
thank
like,
God.
No, it's well, it's important, you know, like I think, at least for me, it's like you have to break those chains of because, yeah, it could be because I don't know. It's a real weird conundrum. I read a lot of books on these kind of things and I kind of try to understand like how does a creative mind work and how is it that there's some creative minds that are really prolific and very creative and out and just like, well, from the sidelines, right? You never know what it's like to be that person. But when you observe somebody from history, you're like, wow, that guy was like really crushing it. Like he was unstoppable, but it's like, you don't realize the context of, well, he's like 50 years old at this point and he's gone through X amount of experiences and he understands or she understands a certain part about themselves that like allowed them to get to that level. And it's so easy to see it from afar and like, well, it's crazy, but yeah.
Entirely. And I feel like what you're touching on is that also that idea that develops in our minds of like the creative genius in a way, it becomes like this huge myth. And I was talking about this recently because, you know, like growing up, being interested in certain things and then also getting into design and all that stuff, you look to these people, like the ones you're talking about, who seem like these heroes of whatever field you're in. And they do seem like these self-contained entities that didn't need anybody else, just had this insane creative drive. And don't get me wrong, there are creative geniuses, but I think we forget because we're idealizing it and looking at it on the outside that it's, there's so many other influences going on. There's so many other collaborators. There's so many different things happening for that person. Sometimes it's just a matter of luck and happenstance. But I think sometimes, at least for me when I was younger, I was very hard on myself for not being better or like being more of a creative genius, if you will.
Sure.
Because I had these mythological figures in my mind without knowing the context. And I think it's important to just acknowledge that it's idealized. It's not as easy as we might think it is. And you're not less than because you're not creating on a certain level. It's just that like everything has a purpose and a context for why it happens.
100%. So well put too. And I totally agree. And I think that the thing that I've learned when I really understood the origin point of the word genius, I realized that it came from like, I think it was like in your genesis, it's in your essence of you. When I really started to understand that, I was like, oh, well, that's the beauty of it. And when you see somebody that you would call a quote unquote genius, which is overly used word now, but it's like when you see it used, like when you see somebody like, whoa, that person is like really in their essence, like that's really what the word was originally used for. And you understand that like, oh, it's, that's what makes them so special because they're literally being them in their rawest form.
Yes.
And we all have that. That's what's crazy. Like it's a really beautiful thing because it's an incredible gift. We almost all of us, I would imagine, is given at childbirth is like when we're born, we're given our mind and free thought. And that's a beautiful thing. And it's amazing to have that.
It is.
Why box it up and why try to copy somebody or try to be somebody else? It's a scary world out there. And you don't want to be judged and unloved, and that's usually the psychological conundrum that happens with a lot of like why trends exist, because people are like, oh shit, like typography is really big right now, like let me jump on that train. But I don't know if the people understand that that's what they're doing. Because I would try to think back to myself when I was like following trends, and I would think like I was doing it for all the wrong reasons, but at the same time I was doing it for the right reasons too, because I was like, that looks really fun and I feel like I can express myself in that world too, you know. So
yeah. And you learn something from that. There's something about mimicry and sort of like being inspired and I don't want to say copying, but just sort of like seeing an idea and doing your own riff on it. I think that's like a valuable, like just visual learning exercise as well.
Yeah. I try to keep those private, to be honest. So I don't share those publicly because, because if you're doing it publicly, that's the same thing. It goes back to like fail privately, succeed publicly. It's like, for me at least, it kind of helps because it's like, those are studies. It's kind of like every time you do those, for me, it's like I'm doing that as a student. I'm like a student again, and I'm trying to understand and decipher that person's genius. What I'm trying to do is understand how they communicate. And I'm trying to understand like, what is it about the way that they're approaching this that makes it different from me, you know? And then like, how can I use this on my voyage of creative journey, basically? So
That's so great though. Like, I think it's so important to kind of continue, like, in whatever form that you do that, to keep learning or like keep having those moments of being a student. It's just like, that never stops, you know?
Yeah. You should never stop that. It's weird to, I don't know. I always felt like, it's like a slow death when you stop learning. It's unfortunate.
Yes.
And then before you know it, because what happens before you know it, you're like, you are completely washed out and you're like, what the fuck? I was working hard and I thought I was doing good, but like now I'm just forgotten. No. Nobody knows me and
you gotta keep learning.
Yeah. Well, I think
do something new, man. Like, take a project that's absolutely terrifying. Like, the thought of it, if like a project comes your way and you're thinking like full just kind of imposter syndrome and you're terrified and you're like, I can't do this. Like, those are the ones that you absolutely have to do. You have to.
Yeah, I agree. I would try to space those out. So like every second project or, you know, because like, when you do those back to back to back, it can crush you. Yeah. Because it'll hit you like a fucking sack of bricks. Yeah. Like, because it can be so brutal, like, if you're not cautious of it. But I totally agree. Some of the most important projects to me have been ones where I was like, I don't even know how I'm going to do this, but I know that I'll figure it out some way. Like, it's just, and then you do, and that's when the evolution happens. And that's really when you, I think there's this thing I used to do a while back. It was called like a 10 minute. We'd call it 10 minute. My buddy Sam and I, we would take 10 minutes of our day. We would go and we would switch off. One of us would give a brief, like a quick brief, like, oh, it's a movie about, we got to make a movie poster about, you know, whatever. And then we would go and we'd take 10 minutes. And what you do is you see that in 10 minutes, how, what you can create and all the habits that you jump to quickly to solve those things. And you go like, oh shit, like I use that texture a lot, or I grade like this a lot, or I use that typeface a lot. And it could either be good or bad, but at the same time, it helps you see quickly like how your impulses are and like your habits and how that gets in the way of you possibly trying other things. And when you see it in your long form work, you go like, ah, shit, like I was doing this for months, but like I'm using the same techniques that I would use in 10 minutes. So, but again, it's all about your design at the end of the day and what it is that you're after. And that's such a blanket weird advice thing, but yeah, it's like a logical test, I guess. So
It's great.
Is there a director or a project that you would love to work and be a part of? It could be something that already happened or existed, or like a movie that you really admire, or a director that's no longer with us.
That's such a good question. It's so hard. There's like, there's so many, you know, like back during there's so many films from just like the noir era that were so fascinating, like especially like French noir. I'm trying to remember the movie, like things like The Third Man. I just think that there were so many interesting techniques and I'm going to look this up right now. Hold on.
I've never seen that film. And I was just in Vienna, and apparently there is like, it was filmed there, or there's a part of it, like where he comes out and he gets spotted and stuff. Like, I really need to watch this movie. Cause my friend Frank was like, dude, you're standing right where he was standing. I'm like, wow, that's cool. I just didn't know. And but he's a big movie file and he knows all about the older films and stuff too. So
yeah, that stuff is like, and I only got recently introduced to it because I, again, growing up in Utah and not having a lot of access to pop culture when I was younger, things were always new later especially when I came to San Francisco and Los Angeles. So, you know, some of these films like Diabolique and I'm trying to remember the name of this other one. I cannot for the life of me. But they were just these beautiful films that I feel like really at the time were pushing the envelope in terms of how they interpreted things visually. And also the characters were so fascinating. There's this kind of a doomed hero that I've always been a huge fan of, where it's like they're conflicted. They're not really, you know, good or bad. They're just sort of like trying to figure out a way through the situation in the best way they can. And they have integrity and they have a kind of morality, but they're still doomed. I mean, it's very Shakespearean at the same time, where it's like, you look at Hamlet and you look at some of these other, like Macbeth, and they're just trying to like get through the morality of a certain situation, a quandary and find a way out. But in the end, usually it's like they die. Yeah. And it's fantastic.
That's human. I mean, that's the irony of the life of a human, really. Right.
Yeah. But I mean, showing those characters and having the ability to kind of like, at that time too, where I feel like there was, you know, the mentality in like the 50s and the 30s wasn't exactly progressive, I would say. So it's really interesting to kind of do that in an era where more traditional roles is kind of accepted. So I feel like, yeah, like French noir back then would have been fantastic to work on. Trying to think, like, there's so much proliferation of good content now. It's really difficult to hone in on what would be fantastic to work with. I mean, there's just so many amazing people. I was always really impressed with, you know, Terrence Malick's films. I know he's gone a little cuckoo on the last few that he's done, but even just watching like the Tree of Life, but I always love like Badlands. I mean, there's something so beautiful about it's so good. Like so the beautiful vistas and the moments and their connection, yes, and just sort of building that story in a way that feels more organic and less laid out through dialogue. Do you know what I mean? It's just so beautiful to experience.
Yeah, that's the big appeal for me to his work, because his ability to connect us with that, you know, is like really, it's just connecting and using film in that way is really brilliant. I watched a big inspiration I was doing. I did these the first one I did with my friend Chris is this Epoch film, and I did a second one. But the big inspiration for that was, besides like my love of Carl Sagan and space and all that kind of stuff, was Terrence Malick's film called Was it Portal in Time or shit? What's it called? Let's see, Terrence. My guy, I suck at this stuff.
Again, I'm the worst at pulling names from things, and also just actors or whoever. Ugh.
Yeah, it's Voyage of Time. It's what it's called. Have you seen that?
I have not watched that. No, hold on.
It's really beautiful. Super beautiful. It's I watched it in the theater, and I think it was Brad Pitt did the voiceover, which I didn't need it to be, but it's actually really good. And it's, I think he just kind of does like poems and stuff, which is interesting.
Yes. So, which is kind of like, what's that film? Oh, I'm forgetting the name. It was all just like visuals. It starts with like an S. See, again, oh,
Samsara and Baraka and stuff. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Samsara. Like I went and saw that and was, again, I watched that alone and I was just like so beautifully affected by it, because it's kind of like this echo of this feeling of our human condition, but then also the vastness of just the entire universe and like this life that we're leading. It's just so, it's overwhelming.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I love that stuff. And so these are all inspirations. And I think, yeah, Terrence's stuff, I think with Terrence, the art form for him is so dynamic and different from like, say, like a studio production, where like even like Fincher, for example, is like very concise and organized. Like when you watch like a Social Network, and that's a brilliant thing I love about watching and admiring films and stuff, is because you get like a spectrum from like a very controlled situation like Social Network to like Terrence Malick's, like where you can tell he was kind of like, let's try to find it in the edit bay. And like, same with like Fury Road, which is just like totally discovered in the edit bay. And it's like, wow, the different approaches are so interesting, and one of them is much more risky and one of them isn't. So yeah, I can see why I think Fincher went his route, because of like his experience making Alien 3 and like how much of a shit show that became for him.
Man,
that film has so much potential to be so good, but it's like, because like the idea is really interesting, and like the core ideas are really cool, but yeah, it just definitely becomes like a studio film, unfortunately, towards the end there.
Entirely, which I can't even imagine the pain of that. Do you know what I mean?
Oh man, no thanks.
I mean, we all know the feeling of like watching your babies die, but like on that level, where like it's on like a so
feature
big
film level, and your name's on there. Yeah, like, yeah, no
just,
thanks.
It hurts.
Yeah,
just hurts.
I have a lot of sympathy for that.
I will also say, like, I recently, because I didn't know any of his work, but like, and I'm probably saying his name wrong, but Tarkovsky's work with like Stalker.
Yeah.
I had never seen those films until more recently. I was just like blown away by it. Like just the approach of kind of these quiet, surreal settings, and just like the tension of the characters, and just moving through these weird environments. Like it was just such an interesting kind of filmmaking to watch. I mean, it's slow moving, but at the same time gripping. And and maybe that's also why I love Terrence's work as well, is because sometimes it is a very slow moving story. Sometimes there is no story, but it just sort of grips you, whether in how he's composing it or how you're really inserted in the scene with these characters. It's just, it's more visceral for me.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think visceral is the word that I would point to it as well. It's like there's something so beautiful about going into that passage of time almost. You're just kind of going into that feeling rather than being like spoon fed things. I think cause like Stalker and all these kind of films, it was kind of, it's cool. Cause my wife doesn't really care for this kind of stuff. And, but she knows I really adore like Stanley Kubrick stuff. Mainly like, I really like The Shining, and I really like,
Shining is so good. It's so good.
Still holds up incredibly well.
You can watch it like a few times a year and still love it. Do you know
what
I mean?
It's so good, like bad. Like it's so like, ugh. Like, yeah, it's so good. Yeah. I really love his work, but, not all of it though, which is great. I like all of his stuff. Like it grows on me in different ages of my life. So, and that's the genius of his, I think. So, but, yeah, I was watching, what was it? 2001, we were watching it in the theater, and like that movie has long ass moments, you know, and I'm there with my wife and I'm like, damn, I feel bad because like, I know that this is not what she's like.
She's suffering. She's just suffering.
It was so funny when I had finished Epoch One, Chris and I finished it and I was like, yes, I'm freaking done. It was like 6 months of torture to get this done. I'm so happy and I'm so proud of it. I'm like, go, babe, come sit down and watch this thing. And she hated it. And she's like, I don't like it. I don't like the music. I don't like this. Why is it so long? I was like, I was so pissed. I was like, don't talk to me. Like, I'm so mad. And I'm like,
yeah. Oh, the crushing moments, right? When we have these labors of love and like our significant others or our partners or just people we even care about, like when they're not into it.
Yeah. You know? I don't blame her though. Like, it was also my bad for like trying to put that on her, like, you gotta like this, and like, so it was pretty fucking hilarious. Like, it was a good like husband wife moment kind of thing. So, and I was like, all right, I'm not gonna you know, rely on you for happiness when it comes to creative stuff, you know. So
no. It's funny because we have to know the limits of the people around us, and be okay with it, because I have a propensity to kind of, I enjoy I don't know how to say this without sounding like a freak, but like I enjoy that feeling of pain, whether it be like something I'm watching, like a film that's somewhat painful and it sort of examines the human condition and it's difficult, it's hard. I love watching that stuff. Mm. The vast majority of people close to me and in my life, they are not those people. They do not want to watch those things, and nor do they want to communicate it either creatively or through writing. And I get that, that's fine. But earlier, I used to kind of take that very personally. I had like a slew of different relationships in my early years where like I would be so hurt that my partner wasn't into the things that I was into. And I just thought that it meant that we weren't meant for each other.
Sure.
But it's not the case. You know, it's funny. It's like as creatives, you kind of, you have this ideal that you're kind of searching for in a significant other or a partner. And it's like a sign tracking thing where you look for these little markers that means whether or not they're meant for you or whether or not like it's a doomed relationship. Like I was very, fantastical about the whole thing when I was young, but sure. it's, you know, you grow and you change and you learn, and then you understand that, people have their limits and that's not a reflection on their love for you. It's just that's who they are as people.
Yeah, absolutely. And you kind of have to accept and not, like my wife and I are quite opposite in certain ways, but like, but we're very similar in certain ways. So like it's also really good for me as a human to like understand that and to really kind of grow and learn with her and understand how she works and how she communicates things. And like, that's my love for her, is I have to understand that and really kind of work with that. And not like past judgment, as long as she's not hurting herself or me or anybody else, it's like I should just acknowledge that and let that be, you know, and then let the love kind of come through that way. Because it was funny, I was just having lunch with a close friend that I hadn't seen for a long time, and he was like, oh, I have my fiance and this and that, and one of my first questions I got from him, you guys fight? And he's like yeah. And I was like, okay, that's good, that means you have passion, you know?
It is good
if you don't have fights. I'm like, it's also important that you resolve them properly and you know you guys move forward. But I was like, that was like one of my first questions. And it's funny because like I have friends like, we have kids. I'm like, yeah, probably don't, you shouldn't do that. Yeah, I don't think you'd like it. I don't think it would work for you. Yeah,
no.
I'm like the first one.
It is funny. It's funny. Well, wait, because your daughter's like what, like 14?
She's 14. Yeah.
That's insane. So yeah, super you had insane. Her so young.
Well, so when I met my wife, my daughter was 3 years old. So she comes from my wife's past
marriage. Got it.
So I kind of just adopted, you know, I kind of brought everybody in basically. So it's called the Insta family basically.
It's beautiful.
But but I'm dad.
But yeah, fighting in relationships though, like that, just touching back on that, like that is, because like I would say I'm very non-confrontational, and I think there's a lot of artists who feel this way too, where it's like we just try to avoid situations that are tense or about conflict that we just don't want to get into that. So we just sort of find an easy route around it.
Sure.
And for me, it was really hard to learn to like accept conflict and conflict with another human being is not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Because the way I grew up, it was just kind of avoid, because conflict means that, you know, you don't like each other or that this is a bad situation. Like this is not good. So changing that narrative, especially in terms of like relationships and knowing that there's so much good that comes out of that conflict, and sort of, it's just a matter of communication and it's a matter of sort of like resolving differences. Mm-hmm. But I think this also translates into projects and working with other creatives and working with clients, that like conflicts are normal and conflicts are part of the process. And it's, there's a way to handle it that can be very beneficial and positive. And when it works that way, it's great.
Yeah. You kind of have to, like let it be and not like, take it too personal. And like, it's a difficult one though, too. It's interesting because my daughter just started dating and stuff, and I'm like, I'll get kind of glimpses of that, you know, it's inevitable. Yeah. But I get glimpses of it and I'm like, oh, you know, like, that's interesting. And I'm like, well, you know, like, what did you do here? And I try not to be too preachy with her. Cause I know that's just, I don't want people preaching to me. So, she's similar to me that way. So I kind of like hear things out. Oh, okay. That's maybe that. And yeah. Okay. And I'm like, and then I just kind of smile like, oh man, she's got so much to learn. There's going to be so many things that are going to have to happen in order to kind of get to that place. And I imagine that's probably what all of our parents probably were looking at us like, oh man, like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. And just kind of like, oh, well, that's kind of how it goes. But yeah, I think that, yeah, I agree. I usually try to avoid conflict unless I have to. And then I'm like, I'm full on like, let's do this chaos, you know, like, and I just kind of embrace it. But I think it's a kind of weird trait, I guess. So
no, it's good to embrace it. I feel like for me, I'm that person who tries to force people into like communicating all the time. And it's not a good trait. You know what I mean? Like I have to find out when to take a step back. But my approach to trying to avoid conflict is just to constantly, like, you know, if I'm having a thing with another artist, I'm just like, I'm going to go over to them and I want to sit down and sort of weave my way into us talking about like what's going on experientially during it, like in the project, because obviously there's tension and there's something happening. And it's like, and then this is how I find out if people are willing to communicatively open up about the difficulties or if that's just not the way to do it and they just need to be left alone, which is also totally fine. But I do tend to have a tendency to force people into conversation.
Yeah.
When they don't want to.
Yeah. No, I'm the same. I used to have a problem where I'm like, when I've had an argument, I'd be like, you know, Lee, you need to resolve this now. Like, no, we don't. And I'm like, yeah, like, cause I feel like shit and I don't want to feel like shit anymore. So let's fix this now, please. Yeah.
It's like trying to get it out of the way. Cause like I do that too. It's just kind of like, we got to talk about this right the second. And it's like, some people don't need to, and they don't want to, and that's okay.
Yeah. And learning to live with that.
Yeah. Yes.
I forgot to ask, how much time do you have? Are you almost, do you have to go soon?
Oh, no. Today I'm fine because I'm working from home. So I've got like all the time in the world.
Awesome. Okay, cool. I probably have like maybe like 15, 20 minutes. Is that okay?
Yeah, let's power through it.
Awesome. Well, yeah. Well, I say that and then like hour goes by. I'm like, oh, shit. Yeah, but loving this conversation. But I really want to talk about your photography, if that's okay. I don't know if you want to talk about that. But
I'm down.
Yeah, I really, when I saw your work, I think I found your, I'm trying to think of, because I've been familiar with your work for a while now, and I'm trying to remember. And I told Andrew, like, can you please see if she can come on the podcast? It would be great to have her on. But I think it was like, it was your photography that I saw. And then I was like, whoa, wow, you design. And I'm like, whoa, you do this. Cool. Okay. This is awesome. Like, so it was interesting. Usually it's the other way around. I'll see like another thing. So, But your photography, and you do like your name is like the Darker Dark, which what's that all about? Is that connected to this, or is that like your love of torture or whatever? Man. So
the love of torture. It's funny. It's a funny. I think you know the we always had this running joke, kind of in my family when I was younger in Utah, and I can't really say I'm the black sheep. I mean, in a lot of ways, technically yes, but it's more like I was kind of that child who came into the family and just did not approach life in the same way. And my favorite thing to do was just, you know, like hide in my room, not hide, but just like close the door in my room and really focus in on doing these intricate drawings of like people being eaten by sea monsters, like themes of just like, I wouldn't say horror, but just like weird stuff was just like a thing when I was young. And I think my mom just like kind of embraced it, but at the same time was slightly kind of like, what do I do with this weird little creature? and so it was always like a running joke about like me being sort of kind of the darker element to our family, but then also just like embracing things that are a little bit weird or off or darker. So there's always this, this joke I had with friends, my family of, you know, like my other name being the darkness, essentially. And then that's it was cool. Like, it just kind of became a thing. So I always like named, like when I started to get devices, I'd always name them stupid things like the darkness. And when I first logged onto Instagram, it was just kind of a joke. I was just trying to like make my name on Instagram, the darkness. But that obviously was not available. So I just kind of defaulted into this, the darker dark.
Interesting.
So that's kind of how that happened.
Like that evolution. Dark. Yeah.
Yeah. One of my friends, Ben, was going to make a counter Instagram account where he was going to post just like very optimistic, super shiny photos and then like hilarious little upbeat quotes.
There's plenty of that shit on there. Yeah. Obviously your friend was addicted to it and it ruined her head. So yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Got false them. Reality stuff.
Yeah. False reality.
Yeah. The lighter
so
light.
So that's the origin. Yeah. Yeah. The lighter light. I think he was going to call it that actually. It was hilarious. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, we always make a joke about it. It's kind of like the funny little name that I have now.
Your photos like move me to that place though. And that's what I love about photography. I love like you saw something special about what you were viewing in your reality and you're like, it's good enough to me to catch it. And like the natural light and just the element of the experience almost. And in your photos for me, this is just a viewer of your and a fan of your work. It's like, there's narrative ones and then there's ones of like, this is a moment. And I really, I really enjoy them both. And it's like, it's something that, I'm very picky about photography, I guess too, because I'm always looking for like the essence of that moment. Like for me, at least I'm like, what was the impetus or that moment, you know, like where that person did something or something. So I'm curious, like when you're wandering around or existing, are you looking for something or how does it work for you when it comes to like observing and taking photos of things?
It's interesting. It's, I'm not that person who's constantly roaming around with their camera outside of obviously my iPhone, but I feel like I could be better at being consistent with carrying my camera that I like to use, but really it's, you know, I usually bring it when I know I'm going to be in a space that isn't just like my house or isn't just work. Like sometimes I'm very, it can be a bit routine and uninspiring to be either at the studio or just my house. So quite often if I'm taking like a solo road trip or if I'm going back to see my family in Utah or if I'm on a vacation, I immediately have my camera with me. And then it's, for me, it's almost like, you know, there's moments that where I feel very emotional and I feel very like responsive to the environment around me, or there's just like an element that's happening, like a firework goes off or we've lit a fire, or, you know, there's something with the way that the light is hitting the trees or the mist. And that's what I love to take photos of, because for me, it's just like, it's almost inspiring, sort of these deeper held emotions within me. And I want to communicate that visually through the photo. And that's kind of the moment I love to try to capture and then encapsulate it and put it somewhere so that maybe somebody else can respond to it too.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Cause that's what it, that's what I get from it. And that's the thing I really enjoy. It's
how cool. Thanks, like, Ash.
Yeah. I appreciate that too, because it is kind of a rare and a raw thing. You're like, this is kind of how I'm seeing things right now, or this is my experience right now. And obviously there's differences in different, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's, for me, it's interesting. I'm new to photography, like, and I like really enjoy it. I've been doing it for a while, but like, I'm new to it as just like more or less, like I'm more interested in it more seriously, I guess. So,
yeah.
But I'm fascinated
It's such an interesting tool, because I feel like, there's two sides to it. For me, the part that I love about photography is the emotional expression of it. And then there's the technical side, which I get a little bit caught up on. Like, I'm, you know, like, I'm not that person who can just like file through the technical specs of what the equipment is that I'm using and just call it offhand. Like, I'm more a person who figures out how to use something organically and then just sort of goes from there. Yeah. If something's intuitive to use, I absolutely love it. Like, intuitive technology is one of my favorite things. But, you know, my partner, he's like a techophile. Like, he just loves everything that has to do with why something works technically. So he's very much about, like, he loves to read about like different cameras that are coming out and like how they work. He loves like sound equipment. So he's kind of my magical go-to for when I need to understand like a tool, like technically, like the next thing I should probably buy. He sort of like encouraged me to buy the camera I bought. And so what without him, I think the one I have is a Sony a7R II.
Mm-hmm. It's a great camera. I have that too. Oh, yeah.
I love using it. Like, I know, you know, I like the DSLRs back in the old days, sort of like 5Ds and things like that. Mm-hmm. I would use them at work just to kind of like take photos of assets, but they were kind of beasts. They were huge. And I know everybody says this, but they were so big to work with. And comically large. Like, sometimes like I hold one again and it's just kind of, it feels so crazy. So the mirrorless stuff is great. And I feel like it lets, like, not only does it let me kind of travel with it, but also be in those moments. Mm-hmm. 'Cause sometimes I feel like when you're taking a photo, it takes you out of the situation. Like, almost immediately get removed, you know, where it's kind of like, well, I'm going to set this up, or I'm going to put it on a tripod, or like, do I want to do a time lapse? And I hate that, because I want to still be keyed into the emotion of that moment. And I think that's really important about like what you're using. So the Sony, I can't let go of. I'll probably just keep holding on to it until
till the next one.
It doesn't work.
Exactly.
Till the next one.
Yeah. I love that camera too. I have an R2 and I have an A7 III. I have them both.
How's the three, by the way? Like, have you enjoyed
it? Awesome. I love it. It's the battery life is 1,000% better.
Better?
Battery life is dog shit on the R2.
Rough. Yeah. It's rough on the two, man.
Yeah. It's like, so I you take a photo, you turn it off right after you take the photo. You turn it on, turn it off. Yeah.
I'm in this habit of constantly switching to the off switch, because I just know, you know, like the battery's going to run out. So it's just like off. Okay.
I have six batteries for that thing. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I currently have four, and I'm just like carry around these little batteries to shove inside.
Yeah. Yeah. But so the new battery, like in the R3 and like the A7 III is awesome. Like, you can go all day shooting footage and video and everything. And like, I was shooting video all day in Japan, and I think I used like 1.5 batteries of those. Like,
oh,
new
wow.
ones. Yeah.
Really?
Like, and I was going all day, like filling cards like crazy. So,
I'm like definitely like wanting to take a look at that, because battery has been like killer.
Yeah. It's a trade off though, because you don't get that massive resolution on the end photo. So the R is obviously for resolution, it's the bigger, like for photos and stuff. But the 7.3 is awesome, and it's plenty enough, honestly, like for me. And I use like, there's a tool called AI Gigapixel too, that you can use. And like, you can basically up res anything, and it doesn't lose resolution. So like there's a slight delineation, but it's very faint. And I can see from your work, like you like noise and stuff and grit and texture to your work. So it's like, you wouldn't even notice it. So if you like, if that was a concern, that's another thing too. I guess I do get kind of caught up in some of the technical things, so I'm curious of it, but I do know that feeling. I have like four tripods and I hate using them. I never use them. Yeah.
Dude, honestly, tripods are I only use tripods when I'm going to do like night photography, like star.
Sure.
Like, I'm trying to capture star photography, but a lot of times, just because I hate dragging around a tripod with me, I'll just find a rock.
Yeah, same.
Like in the end, I feel like I've used like what's in the environment more often than actually bringing a tripod with me.
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of using these cameras, because the mirrorless and the low light and how well they are for that is it's like allows you to see. Because with the Canon, because I went from 5D to the A7 III, so that was obviously again another big leap,
huge shift.
And I would look at the difference, like holding the 5D, and as amazing of a camera it was, and there's something to be said about like having the mirror camera, and at the same time, and the color science of Canon is really great. I actually have like a cheat so in my Sony to cheat the color,
to fake the color.
Yeah, it's called EOS
HD. That is a complaint I'd have about. The Sony's is it's skin just
tones not, are horrible. They're like yellish.
It's
like,
weird.
Yeah, everybody looks nasty. Like everybody's got jaundice or something. Yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah, so that's where Lightroom comes in. So yeah, and I always like make the joke,
I love
like,
Lightroom.
Dude, Lightroom is the best. Like it's
so fantastic.
Yeah, it's like my happy place.
It really is. It's so funny. Like I'll do that. Like when I have a free moment, it's sort of meditative. Like I just pop it open. Like, cause I even like to use it on my phone. Like the mobile app of Lightroom is actually
pretty good.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're on the go.
So I'll just do it that and then like switch back over to my laptop, but it's very like meditative, just kind of like, you know, getting in there and like doing on the little color shifts and fixing things. I love it.
It's so cool what you can do. Like I always say that there's two photographers. There's one on the field and then there's one in Lightroom, or like one at home, you know? And I love that. I love like just taking something. I was like, that's kind of mundane, or I wonder what I can do there. And like, I'm excited to start. It looks like you've probably made that adaption, but like kind of going and using your photos and then kind of changing and shifting them. Like, I was looking at getting into like multiple exposure stuff. I think you did that with the Alienist and stuff. And I actually have a shoot tomorrow I'm very excited about, and I'm thinking about employing that. So I do jujitsu, and in jujitsu it's like a very raw thing. You know, Krav Maga. So it's kind of like it's you know, there's an intimate moment in there that's really interesting, and so I'm gonna try and capture that. It's called the gentle art. And like, it's all black and white, and I'm going to be shooting it with handheld and gimbal, and it's going to be, I'll send you, some photos of it. I think you might like it. And, but before we do this shoot, like I have all the athletes, and these are like beasts. So we have like Liz Carmuth, who's like, I think she almost won the UFC title. She's a beast. And like, Gio and all these people. So these are like top, this is what they do for a living. So I'm going to take portraits of them before they do the match, and then after.
Yeah. And that's fantastic.
I'm going to like blend them together. It's going to be really interesting. And it was cool when I saw like what you had done for that, for the Alienist. I was like, wow, that's really similar to like the multiple exposure idea I had. And that's, again, that's the impetus. And I love that about seeing your work, or just everybody's work, and getting inspired and going like, oh, I think I could do this there or try that there. This could be really interesting for that project and stuff, and conveying that idea and stuff too. But yeah, I'll send you some stuff if you want to see. I've already done a bunch of tests and stuff. So, and I have this whole rig set up with like two spotlights with fog and stuff. And
they're
always going to be backlit. And it's a pretty big production for like the small team.
Incredible.
So it's going to be a lot of fun. And this is 100% passion driven. Like nobody's making money. We're all doing it because we love jujitsu, and like they want to be a part of like showing that art form. So yeah, I'm excited.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That kind of energy is like fantastic to have on a project though, you know, where it's not just like, we have to be here. It's kind of like, no, we all love this. Like, we all absolutely love this.
I simply don't do projects unless I have that feeling anymore. Really. I try not to. It's just life is too short. And like, I mean, I've done the whole thing where I like, you know, I made a living doing this, or, you know, you got to pay the bills obviously, but then like you get to a point where like, like the new rich isn't about money. It's about experiences and like having a great life and like really enjoying life, 100% and in finding ways to create that. And so I agree 100%. And that's really that's all I'm after all the time. Like, how can I feel better? You know, like how can I make this experience feel better for not just me, but everybody too. So I don't know. I love that stuff though. It looks like you shoot, I could be wrong, but it looks like you use vintage lenses too. Do you?
Well, the one, my go-to, cause like, I have to tell you another thing I absolutely hating doing is like changing lenses. I hate changing lenses. I hate it. Yeah. So in the beginning, when I first got the Sony, you know, we had this old kit of just these older Nikon lenses. Like, they were kind of messed up. You know, my partner, Duran, he'd bought them a while ago on eBay, and they're beautiful, beautiful, like old Nikon lenses. And so I was just like in the beginning playing around with them on the Sony because we had an adapter.
Yeah.
And what was so great about it is like there was this kind of like the images weren't clear. They weren't like precise. It was like a bit sort of blurry and grainy and a bit soft on the focus. And I kind of loved it, but it also forced me to do everything manually, which I really love to do.
Super good.
Because you have to understand like what's going on with that lens. And it forces me because I tend to like get lazy.
Yeah. It's easy to use autofocus all the time and just kind of like point.
Oh man. It's so easy. So yeah. that was what I was doing in the beginning, like the, probably like a year or two ago. And that was probably like 4 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. Mm. And then I got this, I have this huge monster of a lens. It's like the Sony Zeiss 35, the 1.4.
Yeah, that's a badass lens, yeah.
It's badass, but it's also hilarious in the sense that like I got this camera that is smaller and more svelte and mirrorless, and then I just like attached this huge ass lens to it, and that's what I use all the time now, just because the latitude, and I kind of use it for everything. I have a lot of friends who really hate 35 millimeters just because they think it's too basic, but for me it's closer to like that visceral experience that you're having in the moment. I love wides and I love the perspective of wides, but I've yet to really find one I've truly fell in love with, and that might also be because I'm lazy. So I need to explore that a bit more, but this Sony Zeiss lens is beautiful and I love it.
They're very surgical. They're very clinical, like, and they shoot incredibly sharp, which is great. Mm-hmm. But I definitely, all the Zeiss that I've played with, they're like, they're great because they give you a really great starting place to go and destroy in Lightroom. So
that's like an incredible point. Like it's so true.
Yeah.
It's so true. And also like I recently I dropped my camera because I do that sometimes. I'm kind of a klutz. And so now I've got this little dent that's like happening with the lens, which is, it's given it like, it kind of messed with the lens a little bit, but it is giving it like a little added bit of organic texture that I feel like I needed.
That's interesting.
So from this horrific situation of dropping my camera, I've kind of found like a beautiful accident.
Oh, there you go then. Yeah, you made something. You ruined your lens and you love it, so that's great. Well, I mean, at least it works out, so yeah, that's I found like when I first started getting back in photography, I used a 35 1.4. that's all I used for a year, and mm-hmm. it was a Canon 35 1.4, and it's a great lens. The irony though is like, if you think that's a big lens, like my go-to lens is my 70-200, and that's just stupid. It's just a stupid lens. Yeah.
Holy, like all the time?
All the time. Street photography, everywhere I go, I have that lens.
Incredibly versatile. Do you know what I mean? It does like almost everything. So it's crazy, but that thing is a beast.
Yeah, it's huge, but it's so good though. Like I can't. Like I use, there's three lenses that I find myself bringing always, is my 16-35, 70-200. Mm-hmm. And then I have this like old Russian Helios 44-2. Have you used those before? The old Russian lenses?
No. How is that?
I love it because it's so shitty and it's so small and so light.
Yeah. It's very tiny.
It's super tiny. It blooms really crazy. And I just recently started getting into this like company called Vid Atlantic, and they make these anamorphic filters that you put on the end, and it gives you that like stretch bokeh, and also gives you, if you want, you can option for like, there's a thin line of like a wire that goes in there, and it flares out light and stuff really cool. I can send you some photos if you want to see.
I'd love to see it.
They're really cool people too. Like it's a cool like kind of like a homegrown company, and they're rad. I bought a bunch of their stuff and I really enjoy it, and it cuts your f-stop down a little bit because it blocks the light. It's a great lens though. Like I don't know. I like all that stuff. I have like 20 lenses. So I'm like,
oh wow.
Yeah. I get like,
you are
crazy
into the lenses deep.
Yeah. No, I try all kinds of different stuff.
I have a few friends like those. But it's good. Like, I think, you know, it's sort of like about to each their own, right? So I have a lot of friends who take amazing photographs and they, you know, they just bring like a little kit with them and they're fine just switching it out. Yeah. And it just kind of depends on what works for you in the moment emotionally. I know for me, just because I know the limitations of when I'm going to feel like taking that photo, it's a brief moment of time. So my inspiration, like I have to take advantage of it when it's taking place. And I know that if I bring a whole kit with me, it's just like, or I worry about shooting it in the correct way, if you will, like I'm just going to miss the moment. Yeah. But that's just me, you know?
Yeah. 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 No, that's 100% valid and true. Cause like, I felt like if I wasn't like, so that's my problem too. Cause in the way that I like to shoot photography is I like to just go there randomly. And then I'm just, that's why I like the 70-200. Cause I can get close to people without like being in their face. And I like to shoot people from afar too. So, and I don't post a lot of that because I know people get mad. Like, oh, you should ask for permission. I'm like, yeah, whatever, you know, like that they're there in the street. So yeah.
But people, let's talk about people a little bit, because that is interesting, because to me, so, and also photography in terms of being an introvert for me, like, I'm kind of that mixture of, sort of like on the surface looking like a complete extrovert, but inside I'm just like roiling away from humanity. Like I wish I could just like hide in the woods my entire life.
Interesting.
And yeah. So it's funny with photography because, it does require like a certain amount of interaction sometimes. And especially if you do want to start involving more, humans in your photography, it requires like sometimes if you're not just taking from afar, like a certain amount of closeness or interaction. And I've been pretty not so great about it, but I do try to do it more with friends where I just kind of try to engage them in the moment. You know, even when Felix and I, we went and shot this thing in Slovenia this year, like I just tried to pull him into my photographs and kind of engage him in it. And that's not like a natural place for me to be, but I think it's a fun practice, but I don't know how it is for you. Like when, like, do you like to photograph people and you start to do it more?
I always have the same kind of weird thing. At the same time, I love going against the grain of my own impulses. So
yes.
Like, and like, so like when I'm in Japan or something, like, I mean, I love it cause it's, I'm not Japanese. I don't speak Japanese very well. And like, I'm completely in an alien place. Or anywhere I go, actually, even when I was in Vienna and stuff, like just taking photos and stuff, there's a couple things that I love about photography. One of them is being creative at all times, because like when I travel, I'd have a big problem. Cause my wife and I, when we'd go on our honeymoon, I was like, fuck, I can't do this. Like, I hate this shit. Like laying on a beach, fuck this, man. Like, and I was horrible. Like, I was the worst person to have a honeymoon with. I felt so bad for her.
Oh my God, I love it.
Yeah, but I was like, I need to be creating. So the great thing is now, like when we travel, like I bring my camera but I've been in trouble though with my wife. So she's like, you got to give me some of this focus time. You can't just go off and take photos all day.
You can't just take photos the whole time.
Yeah. So, but, fair enough to her, I feel bad. So, but that's one thing I love, cause I can be creative while traveling, and like, it's so great to like, I found that it's fun to like share my view to friends and go like, wow, like this is how I saw where you live. And like,
yeah,
this is kind of what it felt like. And they're like, wow, that's so interesting. Why did you do that? I'm like, well, that's what it felt like. That's because when it comes to grading and stuff, it's for me, it's like when I grade, it's like, I'm trying to remember what it felt like, not what it looked like, you know? So
entirely, yeah, entirely.
I feel that from you.
I mean, that's the
well.
Great thing is like, it's like showing perspective. I think it's really hard to, you know, again, with being creative, what's so great is you get to share perspective. And I think that's part of the joy of it, is that you're not alone in your head or your experience of this world. You get to actually sort of like hand it to somebody else and sort of then have a conversation about it. And that's, it's such an intimate way of sharing our experience, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really cool thing. I love it. And I also think it's really important, like, not to go segue off to humans, cause I definitely will talk about that. Cause tomorrow is actually going to be really interesting, cause I'm going to be filming and shooting a ton of humans.
Yeah.
So
it's a lot of interaction,
fighters, and like, these are interesting people, and like, I'm going to try and capture them in their essence. But yeah, for people, I always feel like everybody has a story to tell, no matter how bland they are. And they all like for me, it's like, what is it that they're telling me, and how can I like use my cognitive powers to kind of like go in there and find what they're telling me and then capture that and do that in an interesting way. Sometimes dynamically, but I love my favorite way of taking photos of people when they don't even know I'm taking a photo. That's my favorite part because it's like in American Beauty when he's watching the paper or the bag moving. It's like, it's just existing, but it's brilliantly existing and you're just there to witness it. Like that's the shit I like a lot. So
that's the conundrum of it, right? Like we want to capture other people in the essence of who they are. And sometimes when you're immediately shoving this thing in their face, it takes them out of it. So it's a whole different level of like achieving. I mean, this is why I have so much respect for some of these other photographers, like fashion photographers, or even like more sort of visceral fashion photographers, where they are actually capturing a lot of their subjects in a very real way. I mean, even like Annie Leibovitz's work is incredible for that. Like she's so good at capturing people almost like, and you feel like you know them in a way, or you feel like you have a slice of them. And I think that's kind of like a new place I want to try to get closer to is actually, cause I feel like I can do that with environments. I can do that with locations. I can do that with even slight reflections of myself within the environment, but I've yet to reach that place to really dig deep into capturing these moments with people.
That's interesting. I was going to say, I thought that you, because a lot of your photos, you have people in them. And I was like, oh, it's interesting. I thought that this would be like a normal thing for you. So,
oh no, these are like, there's probably, let's see, there's like Sarah, my really good friend, Sarah, who's in some of them, obviously my partner who I forced to be in these situations, poor Duran, he suffers, but, yeah, these are people where that's the cost, but like I've allowed myself to be vulnerable with these people that I've had the opportunity to photograph with. And I think that's what works so well, but I'm not a person who's been, I don't know, it's really hard to like find those others to pull into your pictures and be vulnerable with them so that they can be vulnerable with you.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
It is. Yeah, it is. It is. It's asking a lot. And that's the thing. It's like, for me, it's like, you should never know that I took a photo, and that's when I'm really capturing you. And that's my favorite. It was funny. We do like family photos and like, man, this is so lame.
Forced.
Yeah.
No, forced. I hate this shit. And I have those memories too, because like my mother is still to this day, and my sister is obsessed with family photos and going to those weird studios or like whatever that person shows up on site. And those people, it was so forced and like hard, and you just weren't that human reflected in the picture. Do you know what I mean?
So weird. And it's, you're like, okay, now hold your mom and smile. And like, I'm not going to do that. Like, how would I want to do that?
Like, this is like not what I would be doing.
No.
So it's really funny to kind of like move from that space into doing your own photography and then trying to like, you know, I think there's like an experiential aspect of what's happening between you, the photographer, and even the landscape or the subject you're with that communicates through the photo. And it's like that experience that's like, you just want to capture it. You want to show it in its essence.
Yeah, absolutely. That's for me, that's what I'm always after. And it's like, the photos that I love the most that I've captured, that they're like as if I was never there. I was just like a blip, and I was just hiding there, and like, okay, I'm just capturing that one essence. But yeah, have you gotten into filming much at all?
I do a little bit, but
it's dimensionalized. It's crazy.
It's crazy. And I think that's where like, this is where like, I love working with DPs and cinematographers like on a collaborative level, because there's so much knowledge there for me to gain. There is like it's nice to come into projects where, you know, you're looking at it with the eye of somebody who's like either played with photography or looked at photography, so you understand maybe some aspects of light and things like that. But there's this other level of just capturing movement and sort of the essence of movement and like how that tells a story. That's like a whole nother platform of understanding for me. So it's been really rewarding working with you know, I've gotten to know certain DPs on a few projects, and the ones that are really collaborative and very open about their process, it's so fun to work with them, because it's like, it's just a whole another kind of communication, and I love it.
That's awesome. I thrive and I love those moments of being with a professional that is willing to teach to. And I'm
so good.
Yeah. That's I was actually talking about this the other night with friends, and where I was saying one of the lessons I learned from understanding how Stanley Kubrick worked is he was always inquisitive, always asking questions and never acted like he knew everything. And so he was constantly absorbing, always asking, always wondering. I love that. It's so key. It's so important.
The curiosity aspect, you know what I mean? Like if we don't remain curious about this world that we are sort of, experiencing, say goodbye now.
Yeah, exactly. This is true though. It's and why, you should be, you should always be curious. And that's why the learning part is so important. And when I studied Da Vinci and stuff, the thing that I gathered from him most is that he was a very curious person. And that curiosity led him to create imagination and all these things and solve these weird conundrums that were based on his internal curiosity. And I think that's such an important part of the whole formula.
It's so key. Yeah. It's so key. Yeah. I can't even imagine not wanting to know more about every single aspect of this earth. It's just crazy.
There's too much. There's another quote that I learned the other day. It was life is too short. I'm butchering it, but it was don't expect to learn from there's not enough time to learn from everybody's mistakes, or learn from other people's mistakes. You won't have enough time to do it all yourself. I love that kind of idea. It's learn from other people. Everybody else is doing these things, making mistakes. Use that as an advantage to yourself, live through that. So I find that stuff fascinating, but
that's great.
You mentioned working with, and this will maybe we'll kind of cap our conversation at this, but where are you going to be in the future? Where do you do projections? Do you think about where you want to be? Is there a goal that you have in mind, an idea of where you want to be?
This question's always so rough, right?
Is it? I love it. I'm I guess I'll try that. It's also rough because it's a timeline. You have to look back at this and it's a time capsule. You're what the hell did I say?
So it's like that thing where when I was younger, I used to hate, we'd do the time capsule thing as kids, right? And then you'd write a letter to yourself when you were younger and then read it later. And I think I was always very, and maybe this is the inner chaos creature inside me, but I always kind of hated sort of trying to expect what things would look like in a time frame from now. But it's not about that, right? So the point is just kind of what are things I'm inspiring towards? And it's hard. There's so many things that I want to dive into. I mean, there's a couple of projects going on currently where I've had the chance to do more live action direction, and that's been fun. It's a really interesting exercise, and I've learned so much from it, and it's been a fantastic experience. I'd love to do more of it just for the fact of the experiential part of it is just so interesting, and there's so much more to learn from it. So that's something that I would love to continue with some of these projects that I'm doing. And then the other thing is just, what goes into content development nowadays, and just the process and the thinking, and then being able to find a platform in which to put these things on, or just having the ability to kind of tell a story or even somebody else's story. I'd love to kind of develop more of that from a sole creator perspective. That would be great. And so there's a few things I'm going to try to push forward this year.
Awesome.
But again, these are all just things that are so valuable to me, as a learning experience, and just kind of pushing me outside of the realm of where I'm comfortable. So I think there's those things.
Yeah. I like that though. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good that you're thriving towards trying new things and testing yourself, and yeah. And a consummate student is so key. And then trying things that are outside of your comfort zone. Yeah. That's good. Cause I'm really curious to see what's going to come of that. Cause it's like a never ending, with photography is it's like the gateway drug. It's like the weed or something.
Oh, yeah.
And then filming and stuff is oh man, it's so challenging. It's so challenging, but it's so rewarding when you hit it. And then you watch these films that you've taken advantage of for all these years. And wow, I can't believe.
And then you sit and you go through it shot by shot, and you're just the setups and the time, and even just creatively leading up to that. Just all the prep.
Yeah.
It's all insane. The shit.
What the heck?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I love that though. And this is, I really thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much. I'm so glad ended up making it happen. Sorry for the delay and the shift in schedule. And I appreciate your willingness to shift things around so quickly. So I appreciate it.
Of course. This has been fantastic for me. Thank you for having me on.
And boom, just like that. Man, what an awesome episode. So happy to have had Heidi on. Really great. Grateful for her time. So thank you so much. And hope you all enjoyed something and got something and gained something out of this and did some self-reflection. And hopefully us sharing our honest thoughts with you have helped improve your day somehow. If you need show notes for this week's episode, you can always go to thecollectivepodcast.com. And for this episode particularly, go to thecollectivepodcast.com/214 to get all the specifics from this episode. So hope you guys have enjoyed this one, and go out there, be powerful, be prolific. Peace out, everybody.